Tonight on The Download, Chicago artist Hebrew Brantley, from the public relations firm Kivett, Eric Sedler, and to preview the big block party this weekend, Tim and Katie from The Hideout. Now, here's your host, a man who is really questioning the decision to wear wool socks, Justin Kaufman.
I didn't know it'd be record-breaking heat. You get to that certain point in September where you're like, you're just staring at those two socks, that the pair that they're match. You're like, oh, look at that. They're you know what? I'm going to go with those today. I have a feeling today is going to be brisk. I have a feeling there's going to, I'm going to have to bundle up a little, like grab my neck area and be like, oh, like take my collar and be like, oh, it's a little cold. Because if you listen to the show, you know that I don't read the weather report. Love Tom Skilling, but I'm a guy. I feel like it might be some sort of DNA from back in the caveman days where you're just like, you have to assume a season. And I feel like we are ready to assume the day before the actual start of fall a season. So this weather is very difficult to understand and predict for the Luddites like myself that won't take my lazy thumb on my phone to the weather app, because that's just too much. I need more time for my fantasy baseball app. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight on 720 WGN. Wow, we've got a great show lined up. I love when these shows come together like this. First in 7 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Mike Fouché, his regular check-in, man behind the Daily Line. The people lining up to run for Attorney General after Lisa Madigan told us all at the end of last week that she was not going to run for re-election. It's startling how many names are coming out, how many petitions are being circulated, how many rumors are coming out of Springfield. Mike Fouché has it all. We'll talk about who is in, who's a maybe, who's a no, who hasn't been asked. Maybe we can just do 20 minutes of speculation. Who we'd like? Like, we could do like a fantasy draft for Attorney General, right? Who needs an election? We'll talk about that coming up at 7:30. At 8 o'clock hour, Eric Sedler joins us. He is the man behind Kivett, but he's also the man who was the partners with David Axelrod for ASGK Public Strategies, a longtime famed public relations firm here in Chicago. Eric Sedler, our guest, will talk about corporate media. There's a lot going on right now to talk about. We could talk about, you know, strategies. We can talk about messages. We could talk about, in the corporate world, there's a lot that goes on. I think of some of these big tech companies that really have a style in which they want to work and at the same time have to deal with things like we see with Uber, whether it be sexual harassment or other things, and how they deal with that, how they're front-facing. That's what Eric does. He goes in and creates strategies and long-term goals and deals with putting out fires. Eric Sedler, my guest at the big table. I'm fascinated today, all day today, having a, you know, I'm just, my curiosity reigns in this case to talk about these issues. These are big issues. And it's fun to have someone of his stature who's on the who's who list on Crain's every year and was in 2015 named to the top 20 most powerful political insiders in Illinois list. I didn't make it. I'm sure I was in 20 to 30 range, and they're just like, there's just no room. Kaufman's a long name, but he's such a political insider. Coming up at the 9 o'clock hour, Hebrew Brantley's back with us, the great Chicago artist, the man behind Flyboy. He's got a brand new exhibit, solo exhibition at the Elmhurst Art Museum in Elmhurst. We'll talk with him about his work. I love Hebrew Brantley. It's amazing, too, he has had such worldwide success, but he's also been collected by Lenny Kravitz, George Lucas, Rahm Emanuel, Beyonce. There's amazing celebrities that have Hebrew Brantley pieces hanging in their living rooms. So Hebrew Brantley back in studio tonight. Very excited. Tim and Katie Tutton from The Hideout, the co-owners of The Hideout. The Hideout Block Party's back. That was one of the best festivals where they tell the city they got to move the garbage trucks from the industrial area in which the Hideout is located on the north side of Chicago. They're right across the street from a lot that essentially houses all the garbage trucks. And so for the festival, what they would do is they would get the city to move those garbage trucks, and they'd use that parking lot for the festival, which I always, whenever I've been at the Hideout Block Party, I'm there like, huh, wow, this is kind of like Chicago. There's something Chicago about this, and I'm standing where the garbage trucks park. And we'll talk with them about resurrecting for the 21st year, the Hideout Block Party. And also Greg Flamm tonight, swap meet. You got something you want to brag about? You got a collector's item that you want to see what the value is? You want to just tell us about the cool things that you've collected over the years? Let everybody know how cool you are? That's why I love the segment. So when someone says, let me tell you what I got. And I go, yes! Especially if it's something super random. I'm a big fan of the Chicago, Illinois politics. I've got this button. I've got this old pipe. Ed Verdoliak used to have a pipe, and I have it. Right? Wouldn't that be great? That's the kind of stuff I'm looking for. 312-981-7200. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Republicans moving fast to get a vote on a new bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. They have till October 4th to try and pass the bill under reconciliation, which is the idea that they can pass it with 51 votes, not a 60 after a filibuster. Reconciliation has an expiration date, though, because it's supposed to only be used for matters grave to the budget's bottom line, which is how they're manipulating it. And since the budget's ready to go, the window's closing. So that's why Republican senators are ramping up the speed on the old healthcare treadmill this week. The head scratcher here is that the bill is actually more unpopular than the last, but the thought is pass anything, pass something, so they don't look like failures. They're moving so fast that even the Congressional Budget Office won't have time to score the bill, which is usually when the wheels fall off these pieces of legislature, because the CBO will say that this many people are kicked off insurance and it'll cost the country this or that. The heart of the bill is just about passing the repeal and replace blame game to state governments. Essentially, Congress is saying, we want out of the healthcare business. Here, states, enjoy. Have at it. Good luck. If you need us, we'll be in Tahiti. If Tahiti's still there. Yeah. This bill doesn't change any of the things that prompted three GOP senators to vote against it last time. But you know what? Still, this is politics. And something tells me last time will not matter. Ooh, it's getting interesting in the race for the new attorney general. At least one on the Democrat side. State Senator Kwame Raoul's in. State Representative Scott Drury's out as candidate for governor, in for attorney general. State Rep. Elaine Nekritz is in. At this point, it might be better to just tell you who's out. Alderman Burke's daughter and possibly Jesse White. No word on the tumblers. On the Republican side, the big guns are staying with Erica Harold, the former beauty pageant contestant and newscaster. I think it's high time that someone named Harold got back into Illinois politics, so I'm interested in her campaign. And I would like to say that the first person that promises to give me a rebate check for, I don't know, anything, has got my vote. In food news, big food news, let us entertain you mogul Rich Melman stepping away, giving the restaurant group to his son, RJ. RJ will be the president, RJ Melman. He's been in the business for a couple years now. He's been on the show. But now it'll take over the entire empire. And it's an empire, hundreds of restaurants. I personally hope that Let Us Entertain You continues with new restaurant concepts. For instance, they should buy the Golden Apple up in Lakeview. You know, the old diner? Yeah, right? Right on Lincoln? Tear the whole thing down and rebuild it the exact same. Call it the Golden Apple as an homage, but charge $20 for everything. Right? Same, replace the old dish rags, the smell. But it would be a Let Us Entertain You homage to the dish rags and the smell. So everything's $25. Boom, I'm a genius. That one's for free, RJ. That's how you start off. In weather, what a scorcher today, huh? To quote my 10-year-old, it feels like we're bread in a toaster. That's perfect. Very perceptive. Good bit. I do feel like toast. All hot and crusty at the same time. You know, George Stamos. Is George Stamos? No, it's... What is Stamos' first name? John Stamos, right. I was thinking George's brother. George Stamos. Still waiting to assess the damage caused by Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. I mean, after Irma, there were reports it would take months to get power to parts of the country. Now, The Category 4 storm just wiped out whatever work they had done to get back up and running. Just awful. Maria was the worst storm to hit there since 1928, prompting one government official to say that when they lift the curfew, they're going to find their country destroyed. In sports, the Cubs wrap up the two-game series in Tampa tonight. Is it me or Big Schwarbs heating up? Feels like every time I turn on the TV, there's a homer into the stands. I'm sure I'm missing the other four strikeouts tonight. But it seems like every time I catch a highlight, he's doing the old trot. Maybe he's playing possum. Maybe he's getting ready for the playoffs. Maybe he's getting his confidence back after that weird experiment to actually have him lead off. No one thinks that might have been the problem, huh? Anyway, every time I look up, he's crushing. Tonight, Lester on the mound, not looking good. The Cubs right now down 4-0. And the Brewers, on the other hand, tied. Don't want to give the Brewers any ground. After tonight, the Cubs come back to the Midwest to take on the Brewers in a four-game weekend series that'll ultimately determine the series and the season. No pressure. No pressure. The Sox, they're in Houston. Rookie phenom James Shield is on the mound. Oh, that's right. He's not a rookie sensation. He's just an old crusty veteran that we couldn't trade. Nobody wants him. Remind me again why some other rookie hasn't been called up to replace him. We really want to see what James Shields has for the last month. Is that the idea? You know what? I just want to see what he's working on his breaking ball for next year. Bears news. Jordan Howard was limited with a shoulder injury in practice, but reinforcements may be on the way. Looks like Kyle Long is going to play against the Steelers on Sunday. And you can include receiver Marcus Wheaton and corner Prince Amukamara to that list. They all will make their season debuts after either getting hurt in the preseason or recovering from off-season surgeries. The Bears will have a tough matchup with a Steeler offense that's all about scoring. What a concept! An offense that's designed to score points. Yeah, but what about punting? We got a pretty good one. Good punter. Do they not care about punting? Also, who's playing middle linebacker? Christian Jones went from possibly cut in the preseason to the signal caller in week 3. Just like we wrote it up, right? All right, moving on here. In basketball, I guess it could be worse. I mean, we could be Giants fans. The New York Giants were so bad on Monday Night Football. It's like implosion city. What are the odds on when Brandon Marshall starts losing it? I'm talking hours and minutes, not days and weeks. It's not good. In basketball, looks like the Knicks are going to wave the white flag and trade Carmelo. And just for the record, we aren't talking about the caramel chocolate candy bar. We're talking about Carmelo, the basketball player? No. That's Caramelo. Caramelo. The Carmelo camp says he will be traded by Monday to the Houston Rockets. If that happens, the Rockets will have Harden, Chris Paul, and Carmelo Anthony. Wow. We'll see if that beats the Bulls superstar trio of Lauri Markkanen, Denzel Valentine, and does John Lucas III still play on the squad? Also, you see Dwayne Wade at the Emmys on Sunday supporting his lady, Gabrielle Union. Again, is he still on the Bulls? I mean, could there be a basketball player that is as famous as Wade that has no basketball brand affiliation? When you see Wade at the Emmys, you're not like, oh, our Bull. Our guy from Chicago, guy plays on the Bulls. No, you don't. You just think, how does that guy have no sleeves on his tuxedo? That's like, and a new poll out says that the Bulls are projected to be the worst team in the NBA this season, which is looking like it might actually be the strategy. And finally tonight, Amazon is looking to get into the glass game. Yep, they want to take the wildly popular Alexa and get it on your face. Yep, Google Glass may have been a failure, but maybe more of a precursor. Could you imagine? Alexa glasses. Alexa, zoom in. Alexa, focus. Alexa, stop staring. Seriously, we should go one step further. Amazon eyeballs. Alexa, pupils. Something like that, right? That's the carry out for September 20th, 2017. It's so hot, we're putting ice cubes in our cheesy broccoli soup. Cold cheese. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is going to join us from the Daily Line like he does every Wednesday. We'll talk about the race for attorney general in the state of Illinois. What's happening in Springfield as everybody either throws their hat in the ring or says they might. Also, a little bit later, Eric Sedler's here, my guest at the big table. Stick around. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier in the newsroom. How are you, buddy?
I tell you, Justin, the only thing hotter than the weather outside is this race for Illinois Attorney General. Am I right? Hey, you next thing you know, the three of us will throw our hat in the ring.
I feel like hot's the wrong word. I would say, like, when your grill is almost out of gas, and you're like, it should be hotter. It feels like it should be hotter, but this will get it done.
My favorite is you've got people in the race, and the guy from Highwood knows who he is right. When I'm going to say this. But now I'm going to run for governor. Yeah, you know what? Yeah. No, money's not. Yeah, money a little tight.
Yeah.
Tight race. Not going to do it.
You know, it is interesting.
I'll run for attorney general.
He was on the show last week, and he it was funny because he talked about the idea of being a lawyer and a prosecutor and all the kind of things in his background that would help him with the job of being governor.
So he planted the seed right here.
He did. That's right.
Attaboy. I'll tell you what, these guys are smart.
They're smart. They came out of the interview and they're like, well, this governor thing's not for me.
Yeah.
I need to move on to something else.
I'm going to be AG. Thanks, Lisa Madigan.
Thank you. What's the problem with the music?
You know what? No, somebody left these Beats headphones here, and I got to say, it just sounds that much better. Everyone walking by, yeah. I'm looking cool right now, right?
Yeah. You're louder. You're more
awesome.
Energetic.
I'm
right.
Wow.
Mike Fouché in studio every Wednesday, the man behind the Daily Line, which covers Chicago politics, county politics, Springfield politics, which we're going to talk about tonight. Mike, good to see you.
It's great to be here.
All right. So the bombshell in Chicago, of course, happened on, what was it, Friday? And I'm not even sure that was what the press conference was for, but Attorney General Lisa Madigan, Illinois Attorney General, steps up and says she will not be running for re-election. Shocker? I mean, was everyone surprised?
Yes.
Or did you start to hear rumblings?
Everybody is surprised. Everybody is surprised. I talked to people that have long-time connections and relationships with her, and everybody was surprised. Particularly because she had been holding fundraisers and telling people just a few months ago, yeah, I'm running for re-election. Mm. And so, I mean, all of a sudden for her to say, I'm not running, was a big shocker.
Now, the automatic question, usually when people, especially of high popularity and visibility, say they're not running for a re-election, they've got something else in mind. And that's kind of been the mystery around why she's choosing to not run again for attorney general. What's the future for Lisa Madigan? Is it truly, I just need to take some time out of public office?
So, I mean, I don't really know her, but she lives in my neighborhood, and I have some mutual friends, and I don't think I'm talking out of school to say that I think from what I can tell, she and her husband are very normal people, and they don't live extravagantly. They, you know, their kids are nice kids, and they go to school, and, you know, they do cleanup projects in the neighborhood and stuff like that. They're just regular people, and I think... I know that Lisa Madigan tends to play things very close to the vest, but she also tends to be very straightforward about whatever it is that she's thinking or doing. And I have a sense that this is a personal decision, and that's it.
Okay, so I guess we're at the point where we can kind of look back on her legacy as Attorney General. And some would say, and I've read in the paper where they're like, well, she didn't really do much as Attorney General. She was pretty low profile. Others would say, you know, she made it out of a job without scandal, and that's A+ in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, like, right.
But how did Lisa Madigan fare? I mean, she's still Attorney General for another, you know, year.
Another
or so.
Year.
But how did she fare? Let's talk about her legacy.
You know, I think she started off, wow, 2002, long time ago, where she was, you know, getting a lot of credit and plaudits for being a progressive and going after some corruption in some small towns and some small government corruption and things like that. But then she really took a turn towards being much more of a consumer advocate. That's most of what it is that she's put her energy into. And those are good things. And I think, you know, she's probably advanced good stuff with that. but certainly hasn't been a crusader or a big boat rocker like a lot of people were hoping.
And, you know, this attorney general has been in the past a stepping stone where yep. where people have looked to the governor's mansion as a place to go, as yep. the U.S. Senate, other places like that. I mean, what has stopped her from looking at those things? Obviously, her dad being the Speaker of the House in the state of Illinois has been somewhat of a roadblock. But we've heard these stories come up over and over and over that, you know, she really can't move up the ranks until her father retires or right. is voted out. But
so in 2009, I actually was still doing political consulting, and I was working for a woman named Julie Hamos, who was a state representative from Evanston. And Julie had hired me to help put together a statewide operation for her to run for attorney general because the expectation was that Lisa Madigan was going to run for governor in 2010. And so we spent a lot of energy building a statewide operation, talking to a lot of people. And then just like this, except it was in July, Lisa announced, you know what, I've decided that I'm going to run for attorney general for reelection. And what she said at the time is that having two Madigans running state government is too many. And I don't think is the right thing that we should be doing right now. And it was very clear that her father, you know, was not willing to move. There were a lot of people thinking, oh, well, she's very close to him. And if he's going to leave, he'll certainly leave for his daughter. But, you know, apparently not. And the two of them, they're very tight-lipped. They don't talk a lot. So, you know, we may never know exactly yeah. what happened there.
I remember, and Mike, I remember I was with you in 2008 in Denver. And Lisa Madigan, the Illinois delegation at the Democratic National Convention to cover then Senator Barack Obama getting the nomination.
Right.
They were rock stars.
Yeah.
And Lisa Madigan was one of them. I mean, you had Jesse Jackson Jr.
Yeah.
You had Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah.
You had Lisa Madigan. Yeah. You had, you know, Alexis Janulius yeah. was yeah. in that mix.
It was
mix.
Crazy.
He had a speech. But I remember that Lisa Madigan held esteem at that convention because she had a friendship with Barack Obama. And
yep.
he showed up at one of her, one of her closed door meetings.
Yep.
She has a great relationship with Barack Obama, President yeah. Obama, and it continued.
And nationally, she's widely admired among Democrats as being a woman leader who's been very solid, who's been very centrist, has been able to figure out a center line in order to be able to take for the party. And you know, I think that that's been, you know, really good. But you know, I think it's it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Why it is that she chose?
Well,
to
let's
leave.
Do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back and now let's size up who's running, who might, and who's not for attorney general in the state of Illinois. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line with us tonight, as he is every Wednesday. Stay with us. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mike Fouché in studio, as he is every Wednesday night here. The man behind the Daily Line, which you can find at thedailyline.net. Covers politics, both Chicago, Cook County, and Springfield. We're
yeah.
talking Springfield tonight. Illinois Attorney General race up in the air. First, on just to set this record straight, the Republicans, they already had a candidate that they're interested
Erica
in.
Harold.
Erica Harold, who essentially was going to run against Lisa Madigan.
Yeah.
So they're not changing course,
no,
even though I'm
no.
sure there's a
I
lot of people making phone calls. Right?
I keep asking about this. And, you know, so Erica Harold, she is from Urbana. She's a former Miss America winner.
Mm-hmm.
She's an attorney. You know, she's not dumb. But it's not like she has this amazing stellar record as somebody that's been working their way up to run for statewide office. She's the kind of candidate that would not necessarily be, oh, we got to run somebody against Lisa Madigan and win. You know, I mean,
right.
I think that
because
she
we
was,
know this in Illinois politics. I mean, Lisa Madigan was popular. She
right.
she would win that election.
Her and Jesse
you
White.
Know, yeah.
You know,
and
yeah.
and the idea being they give somebody a little bit of experience
right.
in that regard. Of,
right.
Running a statewide election, but so do you. You've been talking to Republicans. There's no desire necessarily to replace her with a bigger name.
The deal is that she had run for congressional office and was dumped by the party for somebody else in a previous campaign year,
hmm.
And so there's a lot of feeling that, look, you can't dump this person twice. You can't. That's not cool. And so the party establishment is saying, okay, we're behind her. And I keep asking people, you know, is there somebody else that's going to run? Because there are certainly, there's a long list of state legislators that want to get out of the state legislature.
There has been nothing but stories about people resigning, stepping down, wanting to get out of the state legislature with what's happened in the last couple of years there. I mean, state senators with big names and big money from, you know, and I feel like, you're absolutely right. I would think that there'd be a lot of, hey, just calling about that race. What are we doing with that?
Right.
Like a lot of state legislators who want in.
And I've been asking and asking and asking. And, you know, so far, everyone I talk to says, nope, it's going to be Erica Harrell.
Oh, there you go. So, good position to be in for Erica Harrell, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the Democrats, because this is where you see everybody. I mean, Rich Miller, you guys, everybody has just been like, let's call everybody. And everyone's given a maybe.
Right.
You know, but let's
talk
about who is in. Right now, I can name four people. There's probably a lot more, but
just to give you a sense, on Friday after the announcement, I literally texted 50 different people, and I text conversations with 50 different people because there was so much flying around so fast, and similar kind of thing on Saturday too, and you know, it's exactly what you said. You know, there's a lot of people that are out there. Ed Burke was saying, oh, my daughter's going to run. And everyone's like, which daughter? Well, I'm not sure yet, you know. And so then finally came back that his daughter, Sarah, and no, she doesn't want to run. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of people that are floating names for lots of reasons.
Just having fun with it,
just
maybe.
To be able to get their name out there and be able to talk about somebody, you know.
Well, let's talk about the people who have. Let's start right at the top with Scott Drury. Very interesting that this, I mean, he already had Drury for Illinois and the governor's stuff printed out. He's running. He picked a lieutenant governor, and he's the only candidate so far that he's withdrawn from the race for governor and put his hat in for attorney general. Not usually how you see it go down.
Hey, why not? Right? Yeah. I mean, that's a pivot. You've already been raising money. You got a statewide operation. It's not looking too good for him for governor. I mean, you know, frankly, I mean, he hasn't been able to get a whole lot of purchase. And so whoop, he just makes a turn and now he's running for AG. Why not? You know, I mean, I think that people look at you differently. People already know who you are. Right, at this point, it's not average voters, right? It's party leaders. And there are a lot of times when party leaders say things like, you know, I kind of like that person. I just wish they were running for something else. Hey, problem solved. Now he's running for something else.
Although the problem is that the party leader is who he has been attacking on the campaign trail
in terms of
Mike Madigan. So
this is true.
See how that works out.
Right.
So Drury has made the switch. The big names that are coming out of the state legislature, at least two that we know of, State Senator Kwame Raoul and Representative Elaine Nekritz, who was already saying that she was stepping down, right? Or she already stepped down.
She was already retiring as a state rep. And so then also there's a lot of talk about former CPS CEO Jesse Ruiz, who is also currently the Parks District
Chair.
I was bringing him up next.
Yep, that's my fourth guy.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of other names that have been bandied about, but I think those are the ones that have been most serious.
Kwame Raoul's already put out an ad, if you will, a video that has surfaced.
So Kwame had a very similar situation that Julie Hamos had in 2009. He, in 2013, had the same sort of, you know, bait and switch thing go on with Lisa Madigan. Lisa Madigan was like, I think I'm going to run for governor in 2014. Whoop. Nope. No, she doesn't. And Kwame Raoul had to shut down his statewide operation. So he's already got relationships all over the state. He's got a pretty good fundraising operation. You know, one of the things that you have to be able to do here is in a very short order, you have to collect about 10,000 good signatures. You know, you can't get bad signatures. They all have to be registered voters in Illinois at the address that they write down. And then so that means you need a lot of volunteers who are going to respond very quickly, and you have to get them all in by December 4th. And then the other is that whoever it is going to have to raise about $1 million on their own.
Jeez.
And it's going to cost about $3 to $5 million in the primary, the Democratic primary. And the thing is that there's not really a ready constituency for attorney general. And for the most part, the way that you get to that $3 to $5 million is a lot of it are rich people who are very excited about Democrats or very excited.
Or
about
you run on the coattails of who's running for
exactly,
governor.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, Erica Harrell is going to get a lot of runner money.
Right. And that's a great question. I mean, J.B. Pritzker, of course, is the front runner for the Democrats. Is there going to be an appointed not unlike what they did with J.B. Pritzker, where right off the bat, the Democratic Party in the state of Illinois said, this is our guy. Is there going to be a candidate like that for Attorney General?
No.
Why not?
Well, first off, you just look at Kwame Raoul, Elaine Nekritz, and Jesse Ruiz, and Scott Drury. But really, Nekritz, Raoul, and Ruiz, they each represent very different wings of the party. Kwame Raoul is African-American. He has very strong relationships in Chicago, in Black Chicago. Jesse Ruiz is Latino, but also has a lot of very strong relationships with Rahm Emanuel donors and those kind of people. And then Elaine Nekritz is a well-known progressive, and also she's from the Northwest suburbs, has a lot of relationships in the Northwest suburbs. Those are all very, very different branches of the party. And then Scott Drury, he's got his own area. So, you know, all those people, since each of those folks have announced, I'm planning on running, or Elaine Nekritz is still saying she's thinking over Rosh Hashanah, she'll let us know over the weekend. They're basically saying, this is my turf, I'm interested. And it's going to be very hard in order to get those different wings of the party to give up whoever it is their person is.
What do you see? What do you anticipate here? I mean, this is a short term.
I anticipate, four. I don't think that we're going to have any other major candidates get in the race. Maybe we will, but by the end of this week, we'll know really who the serious candidates are. They're going to be racing to raise that first $1 million in order to show that they're viable, and then they're going to be racing to get their signatures, and they're also going to be trying to meet with as many party people as they can in the Chicago and the suburbs, not really the rest of the state, because really Democratic primaries won in Chicago and the collar counties.
What I like about the candidates that you mentioned, the four candidates, all four of them aren't necessarily, none of them are millionaires. They're not the millionaire type.
Although Jesse Ruiz does pretty well. He's a partner of Drinker Biddle. I guess
my point would be that not unlike with the governor's race, you kind of like there always has been this, whoever's got the most money is going to win.
Right.
In this case, you have four candidates that I could see going any which way. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, because any of those, and maybe, just maybe, we will get a campaign for this office that's based on what you want from this candidate, what this candidate can provide, not how much money they have.
Well, again, the thing about attorney general races is that they don't really have like an issue. So it's going to be really hard. It's always hard for attorney general in order to be able to say, what are you really campaigning about? What is the big thing? And so I think that they'll be each challenged to come up with a thing that they're going to be identified with. It's been a long, long time since there's been an open seat race for attorney general in Illinois.
It's exciting.
So I think we might see some big changes in the way this is campaigned for.
Mike Fouché, the man behind the dailyline.net, which covers Chicago, the county, Springfield politics. He joins us every Wednesday. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Tim and Katie Tutton from The Hideout, the co-owners of The Hideout, will be on the show to talk about The Hideout Block Party, which is coming up this weekend. That's one of the great festivals in this town. It has been for a while. Last year, they kind of took a break, right? They made it more of a 20th anniversary celebration, not the block party. But they're back at it for a weekend celebration coming up this weekend. One of my favorite festivals, especially because it takes place in the fall. And like I said, I get to stand where garbage trucks once parked in the industrial corridor that surrounds The Hideout on Wabanzia behind the Home Depot there in Lakeview or Wicker Park or that weird spot between the two. So Tim and Katie coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. With the Democratic primary wide open for the office of Illinois Attorney General, many candidates are getting a late start getting their campaigns up and running. There will be less time for some to present a clear and focused message. Some may even be compelled to call Eric Sedler. Sedler is the co-owner and founder of the public relations firm Kivett. Kivett doesn't do political campaigns, but instead help with corporate communications, media strategies, and the very important crisis management. He won't help candidates get elected, but he definitely helps shape the public policy they may support. If you know the name Eric Sedler, it's because he's been doing this for a very long time in Chicago. Kivett's a national company at this point with 70 employees in 5 different offices. But Sedler cut his teeth in Illinois politics, once working with Speaker Mike Madigan. but he also he's known for partnering with David Axelrod and the famed political consultant company ASGK Public Strategies. Sadler is listed in the Who's Who in Chicago Business by Cranes, and in 2015, also named as one of the top 20 most powerful political insiders in the state of Illinois. Tonight, we talk PR, public policy, and putting out fires with Eric Sadler, my guest at the big table. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start right with the attorney general's race. I mean, I'm assuming you love this stuff.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, I kind of right at the top talked about that they're kind of behind the eight ball in the way that usually these campaigns start months ahead of time. You know, we've seen in the governor's race, they were doing this a year out.
Right.
You know, what's your advice to candidates that are starting at this late game? What disadvantage are they at?
Sure. Well, this is definitely was a shock for everybody. So, you know, I think that there are a number of different things that these candidates that have announced they're running have to take into account, and they're all in a little bit of a different spot. You have, you know, somebody like Kwame Raoul, who's been talking about higher office. His name has been floated around for multiple years. So presumably he was thinking about the pieces that go into a real campaign. But it's not the same as actually having to implement it. Then you've got somebody like Elaine Nekritz, who, you know, was spent a long time in the General Assembly, just announced that she was stepping down, and then all of a sudden announces she's running. And then somebody like Jesse Rees, who's not been in elective office, but he's certainly been around government. So they're all, just to take them, and then Drury, you know, also was going to run for governor now.
Right.
So they're all coming at it from a little different sort of starting off point. But I think for all of them, the common denominator is they have to figure out what is their path to being able to get elected in the primary.
Is it the same concept that we hear at the national stage where you're like, when you say path, you're looking at different counties, different areas, like this is my path. I'm going to go through Southern Illinois, or I'm going to make sure that I win Chicago. Is it that what you mean by path?
Yeah, exactly. The reality is in a Democratic primary, the vast majority of the vote comes in the Collar County. So I think most of them, and they're all from this area, so I think most of them are trying to figure out, hey, do I have a natural base to start from? So you can think about geography, you can think about, you know, other kinds of factors, but that's probably a starting off point, is sort of like, where is my base that I can build from? You know, another factor is they all have different amounts of money. Mm-hmm. Some of them who have been in elective office that have been able to raise money, they certainly, you know, have a little bit of advantage there. And then there's the infrastructure of putting together the mechanics of the campaign. They have to hire staff. They have to figure out
all that kind of stuff.
The infrastructure. They have to articulate policy positions, and they have to have the apparatus to go campaign. So, you know, if I had to say, you know, who has an upper hand, I think it has to go to those that have been in office, those who have been talking about it for a while and have some ability to raise money and then can show that they can credential themselves because they come at it with a certain base that they can build from.
You've been around politics your entire life. Is when you're running for campaign, you're running for office, running for this specific office, but generically, is it about the personality of the candidate? Is it about the issue they choose to run on? Is it about how good they are with raising money? Like, what's the secret ingredient to make a great politician running for state office?
I think it does start with biography and the personal story. I think that's how you see candidates really break through. When it comes to policy, I think that it matters to an extent, but the vast majority of voters are probably not reading 10-point plans. They're making a judgment about a person. They say, hey, does this person have a story, a personal story, a professional biography of accomplishment or having overcome something or having demonstrated something that I can respect, that I can admire? I think that is what people tend to look for. And I think those stories, whether they're personal, professional, is what helps somebody really start to stand out. Again, I don't think that people really, you know, are reading through policy papers as much as they're making judgments about, is this somebody that I can look up to, that I can respect, that I could feel good about standing and voting
for? Well,
you
see this more in the city of Chicago than you see it in the state of Illinois, but there will be factions or you know, slices of Democratic Party, progressive or moderate. Does that play at all, like the idea that a candidate's issues or where they stand in terms of the same political party? Is that important when you're trying to court voters and trying to win an election?
I think it depends on the election. For something like attorney general, it's not going to be this. It's not going to be the primary issue, because I think you can go through. They're all more or less talking about similar kinds of issues. And even the race for governor, I think if you look at the Democratic side, there are areas of emphasis, and you can talk about maybe who, you know, is sort of more establishment, less establishment. But the reality is, if you go through and listen to them talk about health care or taxes or education or those kind of big issues, there's much more similarity than there is difference. I agree with you, though, that at the city level and obviously at the national level, there is certainly this tension or this debate between what we
like
would
an internal party debate.
Absolutely. Right. Between what would be considered more establishment and more progressive. And you can see it again in the certainly in the governor's race. Somebody like JB would be considered more establishment, and Pawar, some of these other candidates, and even Kennedy's trying to position himself, you know, a more progressive. Ultimately, I'm not sure there's that like clear delineation the way that that we have seen maybe in city council or, you know, even nationally.
You know, we've had conversations on the show before about how you use media when it comes to elections. And one of the things that always gets brought up is that the state is different than, you know, Donald Trump ran on this idea that he really didn't need to have a lot of money because he had media talking about him at every turn. He didn't have to put ads on the TV as much. But when you talk about the state race, it feels like the last weekend counts. You know, that's when voters start to recognize there's an election on Tuesday. So they look at the ads. They look at what is on Sunday night, you know, in the newscast. Is that really a factor? I mean, you're in this business. You make commercials. You do this kind of stuff. Is the campaign ad, the television ad, the radio ad, is it like you need the money for that to win an election in the state of Illinois?
It still is a big, big part of what campaigns have to do. Now, you know, obviously it's not just television anymore. It's very heavily around digital and social. But ironically, a lot of the kind of old, what we would consider to be like old school tactics, like direct mail, are still really common and important. There's a whole other aspect which is less visible, but that is really important, which is the organization and what they would call the field structure. And really, it's about trying to figure out who your voters are and getting them out to vote. Mm. I think there's a lot of sophistication, and as a result, a lot of money gets put into.
Is that where the money goes when you say they're raising this much money? It's going to be the most expensive campaign in the history of campaigns. Is it the fact that they're spending money on this very specific data to get right at the voter they need to come out?
I think it varies by campaigns. The truth is that television advertising, especially in a big metropolitan market like Chicago, is going to represent a plurality of what a candidate is going to spend money on if they have those kind of resources. You know, JB, again, obviously spending millions of dollars early trying to credential himself as the front runner. So there's a certain strategy in that. There's whether it's a good strategy or not, you know, I guess we'll find out. He's going to outraise or outspend. He's not going to outraise. He will give to himself and outspend everybody else. And if that, you know, maybe that's a good strategy. But so it's not so much that I think they're spending the tons of money on data and field, but I think it's increasingly an important part, especially in a primary where you're really having to concentrate on a certain sliver of voters.
I could talk about this stuff all night. This is great. Eric Sedler's my guest. He, of course, his public relations firm, Kivett, a national company at this point, he's got 70 employees over 5 different offices, works with a lot of corporate clients as well as in his past political campaigns. We'll talk more with Eric about, I'm going to transition as well to corporate communications because we see, you know, that is becoming another area with so many more outlets when it comes to social media and Twitter and other places for corporations to put their foot in their mouth. they need Eric Sedler. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. My guest tonight at the big table, Eric Sedler. He is the co-owner and founder of Kivett, national media company, public relations company, 70 employees, 5 different offices around the country. Used to be the partner with David Axelrod at ASGK Public Strategies. Long history in politics, in corporate communications. We're talking about all those issues tonight at the big table. Let's talk about how, you know, and I want to talk about corporate communications and putting out fires. That's a big part of the conversation tonight. But I've noticed back to politics that we've seen in the last couple of years more of an emphasis on almost taking the candidates out of campaign ads. Where we see, and whether it be the soda tax stuff that we're seeing now, just sort of inundated on all media channels. We saw Governor Rauner do this, where he was actually talking to voters about the budget, but there was no election he was talking about. I mean, this idea that that the idea of the campaign ad has, they've just gotten rid of the campaign part. Talk about that. I mean, because you guys are involved in that kind of stuff. I mean, when did that start becoming the way that people who had interest in this wanted to express themselves?
Well, it's definitely something that we're seeing more and more of, and we can attribute it to a whole range of factors, more money being put into policy and politics generally and other factors. You know, the truth is that you could go back probably all the way to certly into the 90s and see examples, especially for people that can remember the old days in telecommunications. Mm-hmm. You would see campaign style advertising trying to influence policy. And so there were examples of that kind of work happening. I think it's become much more prolific now for a couple of different reasons. One is that it doesn't also always have to be as expensive. It doesn't always have to be the big television ad campaign. You can use social media. You can use less expensive tactics to do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, though, the goal is always the same, which is to try to either genuinely move public opinion around an issue or create a perception that the public is getting engaged on an issue. So when Governor Rauner has advertising going on to talk about the budget, he's trying to define the terms of the debate about the budget, and he's trying to either put pressure on the Democrats or he's trying to give cover to the Republicans. He's trying to use, again, campaign-style tactics to build policy support for policy.
Well,
issues.
I mean, this is your bread and butter in this area, but does it work? I mean, do you find data that says that voters or just residents at this point, I mean, voters doesn't even matter because we're not voting for anything, but that we are swayed, the polls come out and say, yeah, now there's a different number on this issue when it comes to whatever public policy is being talked about in the media?
Well, I think that the measurement of whether it's successful is different because you're not necessarily trying to get millions of people to do something. You're really, again, trying to define an issue. So you brought up the soda tax. Had there not been all of this advertising, there probably wouldn't be as much media attention. And it wouldn't become controversial, regardless of what people think about the issue. It's become a big public issue in a way that, you know, there are all kinds of taxes that get passed all the time. You know, there's the plastic bag tax and other kinds of taxes that maybe because there weren't interest groups with the money to spend, these taxes kind of came and went. And whether people like them or not, they didn't become politically controversial. Whereas the soda tax happens to be an issue where there are some really strong vested interest. And so it becomes a bigger issue. So I think it depends if the goal is to create a perception of a big public debate or to put pressure on elected officials to vote a certain way, then the kind of public advocacy style campaigning can be very effective.
If successful, and we see this, like I said, playing out in Chicago right now, Cook County, do you see a future in which whether it be healthcare, tax reform, who should be on what stamp? I mean, are we going to get to the point where every issue that's in modern American or even local politics is being played out on television in front of you in advertising?
I don't think it'll get to that point, but I do think that, again, because of all the different communication tools that are out there, the sort of the barrier to entry is a lot lower than it used to be. And so you can do more things and create more of a sense of an issue without maybe the same resources that would have been required, you know, 5-10 years ago. Ultimately, though, for these campaigns to really take off, they need some combination of an interest group that's really prepared to spend money, or there has to be a genuine public interest in a particular issue. Right. So I think it'll be unlikely that sort of very obscure issues, you know, rise to that level.
Eric Sedler from Kivett with me tonight at the big table. We're talking about all things public policy, PR, putting out fires, things like that, and all the media strategy that goes into being a public relations firm in 2017. You know, I'm fascinated by that issue only because as a voter and as a citizen, I wonder how more than the candy bar commercial, more than the car commercial, more than all the other products, if I'm being manipulated. And I guess that's the question, like, where I'm like, I'm not sure if this is partisan. If it's not partisan, they throw a little thing at the bottom that says, you know, coalition for blah, 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 blah. You don't know what side. I mean, I feel more than regular advertising that there's the risk of that. I mean, do you think about those kind of issues when developing campaigns and putting out advertising for public policy and so forth?
We absolutely do. And again, there's been an evolution in the industry over the years. You used to hear terms like AstroTurf campaigns and front groups and that sort of thing. I think that sort of style where you could really mask who is behind things is not the way the industry, it's not certainly not the way the reputable practitioners operate. I think there's a real understanding that you have to disclose who's behind it, what their rationale is. You know, ultimately, and this is true, I think, whether you're a political candidate, an issue campaign, or a corporate campaign, you have to be credible in the things that you say for people to take you seriously. It is possible that you can get away with that for a little while, but it doesn't last over time. And I think there's sort of an irony in the work that we do, which is you hear the derogatory terms like, oh, this is going to be spin and you're going to do this kind of work. The reality is that we're generally telling our clients, you have to tell the truth and you have to tell facts. You certainly can do it in a way that is consistent with the points that you want to get across.
Right.
But you ultimately have to tell the truth. I really believe that the truth eventually comes out, and it's really a matter of setting the terms of when you provide information and how you do it. But I don't really see a lot of successful campaigns out there that are not grounded in fact.
As somebody in this business, do you have to advise corporate clients when they're like, well, what if we just lied about that? I mean, you find like when they're like, okay, guys, no, please, we're going down the wrong path.
It's funny. In all the years that I've done this, I've never once had a client say, we want to go out and we're hiring you to help us lie, or we're going to go do this bad thing and we want you to help you. We need you to help us do this bad thing.
Well, I mean, I think of the days of cigarette companies, tobacco companies, alcohol companies. There's stated history in this business of corporate clients wanting to change the narrative that their product doesn't do harm or things like that. I mean, they may not see it as a lie. They may see it as we want to present alternative facts or the idea of the facts here and avoid these facts. So, I mean, how do you deal with that kind of thing where there may be a client that comes forward saying, I know this is what people think of us and that's true, but let's talk about this truth instead.
Well, I think tobacco is a special case because it was clear at a certain point that there were these negative health benefits and there really was nothing positive about it. Most of the projects that we work on end up being in a situation where there's good facts on multiple sides. And the truth is usually not owned by one side. And so it really comes down to telling the facts in a way that advance your argument, but also in a way that is credible with the public.
Right.
Because ultimately, you're trying to advance an argument, change public opinion. But in order to do that, you have to be fact-based and you have to be credible in doing it.
Eric Sedler is my guest tonight at the big table. His company, Kivit, national company at this point, a public relations firm, 70 employees, 5 different offices. He was on the Who's Who in Chicago business list with Cranes, also in 2015 named as one of the 20 most powerful political insiders in Illinois. Congratulations on that. We're talking about PR, public policy. And when we come back, let's talk about putting out fires. We haven't got to the corporate part of this and crisis communications. Eric Sedler, my guest tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up the 9 o'clock hour, Tim and Katie Tutton will be here. We'll talk to them about the Hideout Block Party. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, the Swap Meet with Greg Flam. We do it every Wednesday night. If you got some collectibles, memorabilia, just stuff you want to brag about, 312-981-7200. One of my favorite hours of the whole week. People calling in. And last week, they said someone had a mess kit from the Civil War. It's like their great-great-great-grandfather's mess kit. And then so many great things in between. So that's coming up tonight with Greg, 312-981-7200. My guest at the big table tonight, Eric Sedler. He is the man behind Kivit, the public relations firm that used to be partners with David Axelrod at ASGK, which is famous in Chicago for working public relations, political campaigns, things of that nature. Kivett is more corporate client stuff. And we've kind of teased it out throughout this hour. The idea, I mean, it's really, really interesting work because, you know, and I saw some of the writings you had on the site about some of the newer corporate issues when it comes to companies like Uber or Facebook or other places where they are dealing with, you know, trying to put their front facing is that they're cool, hip, progressive company. And behind the scenes, they have the same issues that every corporation seems to have when it comes to their personnel, whether it be issues of labor or sexual harassment, things of that nature, and how they handle it almost always turns into a clown show. Eric, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with companies that don't necessarily believe they need a corporate message?
Well, there are a couple of different points. One is you referenced companies like Uber and Facebook and some of these, you know, highly visible technology companies. There's always a risk when you present yourselves, you market yourselves, you brand yourselves as being one way, and then facts come out that show that you are actually acting a different way. And the reality is that as companies get bigger, problems happen. And so one is it's very important that you not hold yourself out to be something that you're not. So that's one issue that we see happen to companies.
Right.
I think that the other reality is that the way that people get information and the way they form opinions about companies is changing very, very dramatically. You can take just an extreme but obvious example of the airlines and when something bad happens to a passenger.
Perfect example, right?
Before smartphones and before social media, if something like that happened, maybe 100 people would know about it and they would have one-off conversations. They'd say, oh my gosh, you won't believe what happened today. They'd tell their spouse or their friend. But now things get captured on video and they suddenly go out to millions of people and they go out simultaneously. So something that, again, pre-smartphone, pre-internet, or pre-social media would be an isolated event that limited visibility now becomes national news.
It becomes the number one story on national news, right?
Exactly. And again, it happens in a very, very rapid, immediate kind of way.
How do you – is the way that you strategize for that, if you're helping a corporation strategize for the moment that you need to put out fires, how do you – Do you have to put resources to that kind of thing? Do you have to have them prepared for if this kind of thing comes along? Here's the, break glass, you know, in case of emergency. Do they have to put resources into something to be prepared for this kind of thing to happen?
Well, they do. This is one of probably the biggest changes I've seen in how companies prepare for issues or crises. I think of them as the known knowns. There are certain things that companies know from the past, or they know from their own planning process, that there's some probability or likelihood or seriousness of issues that could happen. It might be 10 things, it might be 20
right.
things, depending on the
If you're a customer service company, you probably have a list of things that could go wrong in customer service.
Absolutely. And you think about some of the obvious things around data breaches and outages and workforce issues. I mean, there's some pretty obvious things that companies can figure at some point these things are going to happen. And there was a time in the past when you had days, weeks to prepare for something of how to respond. Those days are over. And I think companies understand that now they really have to plan and be prepared, because if something like that happens, there's no news cycle. It happens immediately. So we definitely see a lot of the companies that are highly visible spending resources, and it's not only money, it's time and training
like
that kind of those kind of resources around planning. So some of them will have, you know, like the plan on their in their office, and they'll say, hey, listen, if this thing happens, this is what we have to do. So it's a real change of emphasis of the way that companies have to plan.
You know, it almost feels most of the times in which a company gets in hot water is when they're messing with social media. You know, as someone who has corporate clients, and a lot of times those corporate clients say the last thing they're thinking about is their Twitter account. I have Johnny the intern on the Twitter account, and something happens and Johnny the intern says, so what, as a reply, or hits the wrong button or likes something you shouldn't like, as we saw with Ted Cruz. I mean, it feels more and more like that's the area that corporate clients need to get better at.
I think companies are still, even today, they are trying to figure out what is the appropriate profile for a company to have on social media? We have these conversations. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Fortune 100 company or you're talking about a mid-sized private company, because there's no right answer. And that's where I think that companies, you know, have to work through it. So I think that there was certainly a time when there was a view that it could be a little bit of an afterthought. You could have, you know, the young, inexperienced person in charge of the send button on digital. I think that part is changing. I think the bigger issue for most companies is how aggressive, how visible should we be on social media? What is the right posture? Is it from a company? Is it from an executive? Is it from a spokesperson? How do we interact with customers if something bad is going on around a customer service issue? How do we interact in a way that is appropriate but doesn't escalate an issue? So those, I think, are debates that happen within companies and firms like ours, you know, all the time. And I think we'll continue to be having to work through that because it'll continue to change.
All right, let's talk about the golden goose. Let's talk about putting out fires. This is the part that I think everybody wants to know about. I mean, if you're a corporate client of yours is an airline, and they have something that happens that's similar to has happened to other airlines where they've mistreated a customer or tweeted something out. I said after Hurricane Irma, you know, there was price gouging and things of that nature and the insensitive responses from some of the airline tweets. And you get yourself on the front pages of the paper and possibly the national news, CNN, is talking about it. What's the call like? What do you do? What does Kivett do to come in and put those fires out? What's the plan?
Well, there's besides the rule that I already said, which is you have to tell the truth. The other rule is that you really get one chance to make it right. Where you see companies run into trouble and you see it over and over and over again is they come out with some incremental statement and it's not enough. And then 2 days later, they have to go out further.
Or they change their tune or change their facts.
Right. So it's this kind of slow drip of trying to manage issues. Whereas, and you can see the hands of the lawyers and different advocates that have different agendas, because within companies, the communication function, the communicator is one advocate at the table. You have lawyers, you have other actors that have a different agenda because they care more about managing for litigation or they care more about other issues. But I think you can see example time and again, you really get one chance to do things right. And if you really are willing to go out to tell the truth, to do it forcefully, then by and large, you stand a better chance of de-escalating managing an issue than if you come out with a half-hearted statement, then it's a half apology, then it has to be a three-quarters of apology, and then ultimately you apologize, but it's not credible because you didn't do it the right way the first time.
There's also the other flip side, and we saw this a little bit. We see this with data breaches all the time, Equifax, where we find out that there was a data breach 6 months ago, or Yahoo, this happened as well, where you're like, what, that was a year ago? And we're just finding out this now? There's a part of managing the crisis is not going to the media, not talking to the press, not putting out a statement and trying to work behind the scenes. I mean, talk about that part of putting out fires.
I believe that the truth always comes out. And I believe that the best way that companies can manage difficult issues is to initiate sharing the information. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to go hold a press conference and be on national TV, but I believe that with the level of media outlets that are out there, with the level of attention that big companies get, the idea that there would be some massive data breach that would never come out, I think is not realistic. So I think that credibility is really enhanced when a company says, here's what happened, here's what we did, and here's what we're going to do moving forward.
And ultimately they do that. It's just always criticized on how fast they do that. I mean, in Equifax and Yahoo in particular, that's the head scratcher to me, that the breach is out there and we know how fast this stuff can instant. You can be being fished tomorrow. And some of these companies wait months to tell us.
They do, but I think the examples that you give underscore my point that they're not credible. Imagine if they would have come out. Obviously, you need time to understand what happened, but imagine if they would have come out and said, listen, we know that there was a data breach. We have stopped it. we are gathering the facts and we're going to communicate as we get facts, but we are going to be the source of information here. You know, that is it's a very hard thing to get companies to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. But again, I think it's just overwhelming evidence that that's how you stay credible, is when you come out, you communicate, you set the tone, you determine where, when, and how, but you're telling the facts.
Have there been times, Eric, where you're in your career, your illustrious career, whether it be with ASGK or Kivit, others, where you made the wrong decision, where you made a mistake, where you said, this is what we're going to do as a company, this is how we're going to get in front of it, and then you're like, oh, geez, I'm going to walk that back?
Of course you make mistakes. You know, some of these things come down to judgment calls where you are making a judgment about what the right approach is, and you...
In the moment,
yeah. And you expect that it will have a certain public reaction, and it has a different public reaction. And I think anybody that operates at the sort of the level and scrutiny that, you know, our clients operate will say the same thing, that, you know, hopefully it's few and far between, but there are certainly occasions where you misread an issue. And again, hopefully you can take that experience and learn from it, because there are certain things where you have data, you have facts, you know how issues are being received by the public. And then there are other issues where you are kind of in the fog of a moment, and you have to make a judgment call.
You know, I think about some of the issues in Chicago. You know, and you're a Chicago guy. You've been here for a long time. And I think about how public opinion and how many times we hear people say, you know, if they would have done it this way instead, I think, you know, I was thinking about was the Lucas Museum. You know, if they would have come out and said it was an art museum and not a Star Wars museum, if they would have come out with the design beforehand, if they would have looked at different locations, like so many second guessing. But the truth and the reason that people are saying that is because they feel like the message and the way that it went about was botched. You know, like there's second guessing in there. Is Chicago unique in the way that cities approach these kind of conflicts? I mean, as you as someone who has managed many different campaigns in so many different areas, is Chicago a unique city when it comes to public opinion and dealing with this kind of stuff?
Well, Chicago definitely has a culture of big spirited debates, and that's for sure. And you can see it. Yeah, really, you look back on all different kinds of big issues. It can be something like the Lucas Museum that you mentioned, any sort of big issue that's happening. We could go back, even
soda tax happening,
the
right
soda
now, right?
Tax, yeah. or other kind of big land use, big infrastructure projects. So I think it's healthy in the sense that I think that public input is important. I think that having community meetings and getting public input is part of the public process. It's how you build trust in different kinds of projects over time. But the process itself is generally very, very messy, because in a lot of these things, again, you have different groups. You have the city, you have the mayor, they're trying to advance a certain thing. You have the other entities that they have their own agenda. Some of them are, maybe they're not from Chicago, they're not accustomed to kind of the rough and tumble that happens here. So I think it's true. But in every big city that I've worked in, there are certain issues that get people,
get their attention. Yeah.
And usually it involves issues around how public land gets used, transportation, congestion, all those kind of issues that are real, you know, that affect people in a pretty immediate way. But again, I think on balance, Chicago maybe has a little bit more of this kind of approach, but overall, I think it's more healthy than not.
You know, I never think of politics as a place where it's just constant campaigns. I mean, obviously they run campaigns to be elected, but what we've seen, and I guess in this conversation, almost every item that a mayor gets behind or a governor gets behind or an issue or a piece of legislation, whatever it might be, there needs to be a campaign that goes along with that. Is that new to politics in the way that there needs to be more thought on the long-term projection of how this is going to play out, what we need to do to push this, to get people behind this, as opposed to, I'm just going to do this and see what happens?
Yeah, I definitely think that there is more systematic, we can call it campaign-style tactics, that go into policy issues. And again, I think that it's a function of, you have outside interests that have money to put into issues, and you also have all these different platforms available to engage the public or create a perception that you're engaging the public. there's no question when you talk about big issues, if we take the state, for example, whether it's tax reform, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, that there are going to be vested interests that are going to try to define the issue. Now, it doesn't mean that there's more of a vested interest on one side of an issue or right. not, because there's a whole history of organized labor being very active in policy issues. There's a history of the business community being active. So it's not so much that it's one political faction over another. I think it's more a function of there are high stakes issues, and there's both, I think, a combination of more yeah. money and more ways to
And they need to get it right. My last question tonight, a question I ask a lot of people who come through, artists and other people from Chicago. I mean, you have offices set up all around the country, and this is you've seen your brand expand in terms of corporate clients. I mean, a lot of people in New York and Washington, D.C., to just to name a few. Why Chicago? Why stay here? What is it about Chicago that keeps you, Eric Zedler, here?
Well, I think that Chicago is the best city in America, and one of the things about working in different places is when you say you're from Chicago, every time I say it, I just got back from New York today. You say I'm from Chicago. Anybody that's been to Chicago says that is a great city. That's a beautiful city, and I think it's just a fantastic city. We have our challenges like any other big city, and it's easy to focus on some of those issues, and they need to be focused on and they need to be addressed. At the same time, I think if we compare Chicago to any other big city, we have just tremendous advantages and great, great people. You just always hear about, you know, the people who live in Chicago, the beauty. I think people are just surprised when they come here and they see what Chicago has to offer. So to me, Chicago is just is a great city.
Eric Zedler, his company Kivett, the public relations firm, a national company at this point, 70 employees, 5 different offices around the country. Zedler was listed to the Who's Who in Chicago Business by Crain's, and in 2015 also named as one of the top 20 most powerful political insiders in the state of Illinois. Eric, can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing your secrets here at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, Tim and Katie Tutton going to talk about the Hideout Block Party. We were going to have Heber Brantley on, but he called in sick. How about that? We rarely have that happen. I'm surprised we don't have that more. I hope this isn't the beginning of a mad dash. You know, you get a run on a couple, like it's like in baseball where it's just like, uh-oh, the seventh, it broke out, open in the seventh inning.
Right.
6 runs.
Yeah. Summer colds are the worst.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to see a doctor's note.
I know, right? We'll get him back at some point. We've had him on before. He probably looked at his itinerary, and he was like, "What? No, this guy again? No. Hachu. I'm out.
I like Pete, but the news guy and the host, yeah. Forget it.
No, not these guys again. That was brutal last time." All right. So we could talk about some. We should just talk about what he talked about last night about the people who sat next to me in the theater took their shoes off and ordered carryout. Ate dinner. We'll just do that again. We'll just encore presentation of me complaining about going to the movies. We'll just do that coming up in the 9 o'clock. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Like I said, Heber Brantley was going to join us tonight, but he's sick, so he will be rescheduled, which is fine. I hope we can do it, because I think the Elmhurst Art Museum, his new exhibit runs till November.
Oh.
So I think we can get him on again. I love that dude. I think he's one of the best artists. If you haven't seen his stuff, you see Flyboy. The sculptures were right here in Pioneer Court for a while, a couple years back. He's at the Cultural Center, but he also did the murals on the Green Line at McCormick Place. It's just a full-out mural he did. There's one in the South Loop on Wabash.
Got one up in Rogers Park.
Next to the Five Guys. but he's got a new exhibit, and I'm looking forward to asking him about that character because he continues that character. It was featured heavily in the Chance the Rapper video, Angels. So we'll have that conversation with him when.
Let's wait about 10, 12 days.
Yeah, I don't want to
catch either. Anything.
Exactly. I don't want to get sick either. That's, you get to a certain point now where it's funny. Like last night we did an hour, right? And we were, you and I, Pete, were messing around, getting the carry out ready. And we were joking about the character that I do, Ed Buss, the alderman, right? I haven't done him on the show in a long time. Hello. Sort of a dopey, long-time Chicago alderman that doesn't realize that the world is, it's not the 70s anymore.
Yeah.
That's the character, right? And he runs unopposed in a fictional 53rd ward, and but it's all old-school Chicago. And I wanted to do the piece. I wanted to do the piece. Ed Buss nominates his daughter, Tanya. Tanya Buss, who goes to Mother Macaulay,
mm-hmm.
and in the lore, and dates linebackers at Notre Dame. Daddy, this is this. That's, there's a funny line we had in one script where it was like, "Daddy, this is Latuan. He's a linebacker at Notre Dame." He's like, "Hey, good. They make men at that school." Like it's like, but the issue being that we did a bit last night. I mean, life imitates art. The minute we were talking about that on the way to, we were joking about that in the car ride to Berwyn on Friday, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was on Saturday or Sunday, Alderman Ed Burke, real Alderman Ed Burke, is like, I think my daughter would be good for it. Which one? I don't know. Either of them. I was like, what is happening? So anyway, we did a bit last night where it was like we called him, and I had a hard time.
Got to practice.
The voice is down, you know, like this. Dems and does Chicago, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you do it with a little force, and I'm out of practice where I was like, I was had a coughing fit. Like even this morning, like when I woke up, I was like, it's like it just scratched my voice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like you're a stage actor. You have to practice your instrument.
Right.
You know?
I need to go into a closed room like I'm an opera singer.
Right.
And instead of going la 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 la, I go dum dum dee dum 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 Chicago.
Exactly.
And if you live next to that person, you're like, knock it off. That's what I need to do. That's not the sausage that the Chicago. All right, I'm ready.
Yeah, yeah,
I need to get stretched out like mm-hmm. I'm like a my Ed Buss is like Mike Montgomery.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you got to stretch him out to start him. Right. That's it. Yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about this, and this might be a good opportunity. We've been so jam packed with the Blackhawks yesterday, but we had a great show in Berwyn at Laverne's Tavern in Berwyn on Friday.
Yeah, it was
thanks
great.
To everyone who came
Love
out.
That
thanks
place.
To the for Hometown Voices for Allstate. That was great. I kind of wanted to stick around. We didn't really. It was funny because right when we left, you know, we drove separately. I hit traffic on 290 because it was the end of Riot Fest.
Oh.
Riot Fest had been let out in Douglas Park, and there was just like a mad dash on 290 to get into the city. And I was like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah. That sucks.
Yeah.
We took the 55.
Yeah, so it was like it was 290 was totally backed up at 10:30 at night on a Friday.
Damn you Danzig fans. I don't even know who was there.
Bad brains. Bad brains fans have to take 290. It's just part of the lore. No, but the other thing I was gonna say is that, you know, I feel like there's so many things that we called out. Like in that show, but also in the ride out, we rode out on 290. Haven't been on that stretch, and we took Lower Wacker from the station to right into 290 there. And I was like, why not give Amazon this building, the old post office, right? The one right above 290 there. No one, it's been just sitting there doing nothing. Somebody bought it to develop it, but it's going nowhere. And then I saw a piece in the paper, and I think it was a manual saying, what about the old post office? I feel like we're 15 minutes ahead of our time. That's it. We're not like an hour, day, week, 15 minutes ahead.
You're not being bugged, are you?
Could be. I did hire Paul Manafort for some work.
Is there something going on in your car? Well, no. What did I say? I don't think I said anything.
No. Yeah, and then we were talking last night about the experience I had at the movie It. And I have to talk about the movie It as well. Have you seen it?
No.
Are you going to see it?
No.
I'm not going to spoil. I don't care about the spoilers and stuff. But and I always hear, and Brian Altimer, we're talking to him, he's like, oh, I loved it. Saw it on the first night. So many people, so good. You know, Rotten Tomatoes, 100%. I think it's the genre in general.
I mean, it's Stephen King.
It's Stephen King.
So
but,
is it a horror suspense?
It's horror suspense clowns.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the trailers.
Yeah. And I saw the trailer, and I was like, oh, my. Like, I spooked myself. I was like, this is great. And I give my wife a ton of credit because she doesn't like horror films, and she was like, you know what? Let's go see it. You know, I know that you wanted to see it. And I was like, oh, that's so nice. So I was like, I was prepared for it. But I found myself three or four different times, and it's not a mark of a good movie, turning at the same time as my wife to each other going, are you serious?
Like rolling your eyes.
Yeah, like a roll eye kind of. Oh, is this supposed to be funny? Is it? There's like a montage in the middle of the movie where the kids clean up blood to an 80s song.
You're the best.
Yeah, it's like that, but you're like, I don't, is it supposed to be fun? Like, is it supposed to be funny? Is it supposed to be like a throwback to the
parody? Yeah.
And then the actual, like, freak stuff, the, you know, we're supposed to scare you and crazy monsters and stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm not, and then I started to think about it. I'm like, maybe it's me, and maybe there's something of my makeup that I'm not that easily scared by a film that's trying to scare me. You know, get me in a haunted house and forget about it. I don't like that at all, right? I don't like the corners and darkness and getting, you know, jumping around an open door, that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying I'm not scared, but I wonder if the medium of film or TV, if at the end of the day you're like, that didn't really scare me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really watch any horror. I mean, you know, Stranger Things, I guess, is considered. Is that considered a horror, kind of a horror thing?
Right.
I don't. It could be. Is it a suspense? Is it more suspense than horror? Like, what about, like, you know,
it's a clown that's like eating kids or something?
Clowns are annoying. I don't find them scary.
Yeah, and I don't know. You know, like, I don't find them scary either. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, I think there was more. It wasn't fear. It was. There was emotion in the fact that, you know, kids are going missing. You know, these poor kids. Like, and as a dad, I was just like, that's terrible. But I wasn't like, oh, God, the clown.
Could you gauge the audience reaction, the other people, like your Chinese food friends?
No, they were not. It was hard to tell what the reaction was when they were rubbing their naked feet together.
couldn't hear the movie over their utensils.
I went to the restaurant afterwards. And the waiter had seen the movie the same day, and we started to compare notes. And he mentioned a plot point. He's like, well, this is what this means, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I didn't see any of that because I was focusing on the microwave hot dogs and the naked feet on the people that were next to me. Somebody brought in, if you didn't listen last night after the Hawks game, I was at a movie on Saturday. I'm starting to get mad about this again. I was at a movie on Saturday where someone brought in actual takeout, carry out food, like a huge, you know, white plastic bag of like five different styrofoam containers, and in it was hot food from a restaurant. Hot, smoky, smelly food. And not the kind where you're like, oh, that's so good, that chicken smells so good. No, it smelled like microwaved hot dogs. That's what we decided it smelled like. It stunk up the whole entire movie theater. Who does that?
Yeah.
So, and then on top of it, the woman who was sitting next to me, who also was part of the group, she took her shoes off, her flip-flops or whatever she was wearing, and she had no socks on. And so her bare feet were on the recliner. This was one of these recliner movies. So she was essentially laying down barefoot and using her right foot to scratch her left foot. Does it get any grosser than that?
No.
I mean, I know we do the worst on this show. I know everything about it, and this would be the number. That's why I said last night we played the worst by me complaining. But there's nothing that beats that.
I mean, that is the worst.
I mean, I feel like I want to write a letter to the theater now. And, you know, now it's the second night of complaining about it, and get my money back. You know, just send a thing and say, hey, man, I comp my parking or something next time.
I mean, because it did take you out. It did take you out of the movie.
It ruined the movie experience, and on top of it, no one should be... no one should do that. I believe there are rules. These people broke those rules, and their staff did nothing about it. Now, I guess you could say I should have narked on them. I should have gone, excuse me, there's somebody up there with some microwaved hot dogs. You need to take care of this, guys. And the teenager would come up here with a little flashlight and be like, put that styrofoam away. But anyway, I just don't know how we got through three checkpoints.
Yeah, and you're not, I mean, it was crowded.
Yeah.
So, cool. I mean, you're not the only
not
one
the
that's
only one.
Smelling this.
I guarantee somebody else is listening right now to the download right now going, I was there. I saw it on Saturday night as well. And I'm not getting into the game where I want to badmouth the actual company. It was a theater in Chicago.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, you know, come on, man. Don't let people bring in five entrees.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, that's, I guess I'm just kind of a proponent of, I go to the theater, I get my popcorn at the theater, I don't bring any, you know, I sometimes steal in my own, I bring in my special toppings, you know, that's about all that I'll do, because, you know, some theaters, they don't have the good, you know, the free toppings, sometimes you have to pay for it or whatever, so I'll stack those in my pockets, but I'm buying the popcorn. I'm buying my Coke there. I'm not, like, bringing anything in.
I am not against bringing things into the theater. I mean, Target, Jewel, these places now design candy for that experience. If you go to the Target aisle where the candy's at, they will have boxed candy that looks like the candy you'd get at the movies. Pretty much for the specific idea that you should bring this to the movies.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not hiding that. No one's trying to, you know, stop you from smuggling that in. But this was straight up, I mean, hot food.
Yeah, that's egregious.
I guess when I have friends and we say we want to go to the movies at 7:30, I've never had anybody, and I know there's a whole dine-in craze, and that's a different story, but I've never had anybody go, well, why don't we just get food from the taco place on the corner? We'll bring it in, and we'll watch the movie and eat at the same time. No one would ever suggest that. It's like, let's eat after, let's eat before.
Yeah.
What's happening, Pete? What's happening to society?
I know. I mean, and I'm kind of old school in that I don't even, you know, like, so, you know, this is a fancy theater where you can bring drinks and stuff. It's like, I'm from, you know, I like just like, oh, I'll just get a Diet Coke.
Right.
Or I'll go to the fancy things and I'll mix some Mr. Pibb with the lemonade. You know, I'll go nuts.
Have at it.
And so I was like, you know, like, why can't we go through, we can't go 90 minutes without somebody having a beer? I love beer. I drink beer.
Yeah.
But I can go 90
agreed.
Minutes without, like, having a, you know, oh, man, I need a Goose Island to get through it. You know, I don't know. I mean,
there are a lot we reminded of my wife and I were talking about like moments. She says I'm annoying at the theater because I'm always like scratching at my beard. And there was one time she loved to tell this story this weekend. There was one time where she actually got up and moved from sitting next to me because I was playing with my beard while watching the film. So people have annoying traits. There's one beautiful one that happened where I was at a packed theater. It was not an assigned seat, so we sat like in the second row, and it was for Moonrise Kingdom back in the day. I don't know why it was so packed, but I was looking on my phone beforehand, and there was a woman next to me, and I'm just kind of looking and you know, like looking at you know, fantasy baseball or whatever, and she's like, I really hope you're going to turn that off when the movie starts, and I'm like, lady, please. Like, there's nothing wrong. Like, it hadn't started. We're no, you know, you could do that until the point, right? And I'm like,
well,
yeah, all right, calm down, right? So the best part about the story is I just put it in my pocket and it's over. And about an hour in, it's all quiet, and I just hear, and I'm like, it's me. It's someone's calling me.
At least you put it on vibrate.
Yeah, but it was so awesome because I just kind of looked at my leg, and I looked at her, and she was just giving me the death stare, and I'm like, you were right. I should have shut it off. You're right.
When was this? Because I've gotten in a big fight with my friend Stephanie about this because we used to go to movies quite a bit together, and she would always text. Like, she'd be texting.
During the movie?
No, during, like, the trailers and the previews and the commercials. And I was like, once the theater is dark, you are off your phone.
I'm with you there. I'm with you. This is before. We're talking about when
you're just sitting there and you were doing like, the trivia about Jennifer Aniston
look.
Or whatever. Yeah.
A new show coming out about teenagers in love. Yeah, no, I don't. No, I'm not. They don't give my attention on that.
Yeah, okay.
The new Chevy is out.
Yeah.
You know, Colgate toothpaste. It's so good.
That's fine.
I love, we'll end it here. It's 847 says, this is Sue. Sue says, a little cheese to accompany your wine. Come on. What's the not? Are you not on the same page with me, Sue? I mean, you would do the same thing. If you had a radio show and a high prolific artist canceled at the last minute, you too would complain about somebody eating carry out and taking their shoes off at the theater.
I don't see how anybody could be pro eating Chinese food. Hot, warm Chinese food or hot Chinese food and taking off their shoes in a theater. That is a disgrace.
It's a disgrace. It's absolutely a disgrace. I'm just so... I don't know, man.
Who raised these kids?
I don't even know. They seemed like adults. They were adults. My favorite part, though, and I left this out last night, was the guy who brought the food in was last, right? So there was like a group of five or six people. And the woman sat next to me. And I think it was his girlfriend or wife or whatever it was. And some other guy sat next to her, and they had him on the other end. And he stopped where he was. He goes, I've got three. Guys, did you check your thing? And they're like, it doesn't matter. We're all in the same way. He's like, no, I got three. This is mine. So he made his whole friends like get up and move one down
over
because he had to have that seat. And then I'm like, man, if he would have been on the end, that would have been okay because he was the guy who was eating all the food.
He made his friends move because he wanted number three.
He got real serious on what the actual assigned was, even though they're all together. And the one guy was like, it doesn't really matter, Jake. It's like all the same.
Yes, it does. It's three. I'm three. What's yours say? Mine says five. Five's over there.
Oh. Oh, man.
I was like, you guys are all sorts of wrong. (312) 981-7200 to text line to call. 630 says, what about the same people who bring that kind of food on an airplane? Yeah, ridiculous. I think the most embarrassing times I've ever had on an airplane is when I'm like, oh, I think I'll get Taco Bell and bring it on the plane. Then you're like, why did I do that? I used to do that. You know where I used to do that? On the Metra. I used to do that where I get to Ogilvy. When I was in Columbia College and I was still living at home in Wonder Lake, I would get on there. I'd go down to that food court and I'd take the food on there. And I realized after like the second or third time, I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I going to Taco Supreme? Carve out 5 minutes and scarf that thing in the food court.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. 708 says, how about these pieces of human garbage? Good start. That cannot eat the popcorn off the top, but have to somehow dig down into the middle of the bag and ruffle the paper bag for 20 seconds at a time. Human garbage. Wow. It was really funny, the cacophony of the minute that the movie started, you know, the trailer. You could just hear in the theater everyone just wrestling with plastic
stuff,
and stuff that they brought in. Like, no one was buying it. let's see what else we have here. 1630 says, once had a lady sneak a chicken dinner and a bottle of champagne in front of me at the movies.
No.
815 says, my wife and I had dinner at Red Lobster right before a movie once, and then during the film I look over and she's eating the shrimp leftover from dinner. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. That is weird.
That is, shrimp is not movie food.
No. And then 773 says, my friend went to the theater to see It. And there was some doofus dressed as the clown holding a red balloon.
Maybe popcorn shrimp.
There you go. I just love the idea that you'd walk in and there'd be a clown with a red balloon. You'd be like, really? This is what we're doing? That's not scary. That's dumb. You got to feel real dumb about yourself. Thanks, Rob. Listening to The Download here on 720 WGN. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flam's going to join us for the swap meet. Evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. 312-981-7200. Always fun. Greg Flam in the building. Hopefully he brings another one of his awesome Bears posters. We've seen the Junkyard Dog one. There was the Blues Brothers one. The one we had last week was just an awesome one of old Soldier Field, so Greg will probably come in with something. He will not disappoint. 312-981-7200. Well, coming up this weekend is the annual Hideout Block Party. Yes, the Chicago staple brings great music, food, and booze to the Hideout grounds. They make the city move the garbage trucks from across the street to make way for the bands like 11th Dream Day, Man or Astro Man, or some of the Hideout legends like John Langford. Last year, the Hideout Block Party took a break, changed form a little bit, but this weekend they get back to the roots to celebrate the Hideout's drinking age. They are 21 years old. The Hideout is a very special place that many consider to be the best live music venue in Chicago. On the line with us, two of the co-owners of the Hideout, Tim and Katie Tutton. Tim, Katie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Justin. Hi, Justin.
So let's talk about this. Why bring the festival back in this iteration? Last year you had the 20th anniversary, and you kind of went away from the idea of a block party. Why bring it back?
What we decided was the Hideout Block Party, we were really happy. It got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I kind of used to think that the Hideout Block Party should be a blockbuster, like the biggest, massivest, largest thing that we could do on our block. And after, like, last year when it was our 20th reunion, we were talking to our friends, and our friends were saying, you know what, let's just do it the way we used to do it, like a party. More instead of a blockbuster party, a block party, put the party back in it. Mm-hmm. So last year we just did it the way we did it for kind of fun, like in the 90s. And it was so much more, it was so fun. And it's basically everybody that was there, our people that come to the Hideout, hang out at the Hideout. And so that's what we're doing again this year, but we're doing it for 2 days this year.
I love it. Go ahead, Katie.
It's an all-ages show, and we want to encourage people to bring their families, and we're doing the crowd-out rehearsal, which is this really cool thing that they're doing across the whole city with Illinois Humanities Festival and the Chicago Humanities Festival, and each ward is going to be represented with a choir, and the Hideout's the second ward, and we're going to have a rehearsal that day at 2 o'clock.
Saturday, yeah.
Yep.
Oh,
so that's pretty cool and different. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, talk about the themes, because you got a couple themes that you're putting forward on the stages and the different nights for the block party.
Well, really, so what happened was now at the Hideout, it used to be we used to kind of set up parties, but the people who come to the Hideout, they, which is really a democratic thing, they kind of take over now. And so last year after the block party, 11 Dream Day played. And Rick Rizzo mentioned that he was turning, and I can say this because he's publicly said it, he's turning 60 years old this year.
Wow.
Okay? And I know, for being like a killer rock guitar god, it's weird to think of that number 60. And it turned out that John Langford is also turning 60. And Tara Key, who is the killer guitar player of Antietam, is turning 60. Rick Brown is turning 60. So Ira Kaplan from Yellow Tango, he's turning 60. Sue Miller from Lounge X and Julia Adams from Lounge X, they're turning 60. So we thought, actually, that's pretty cool that these major rock and rollers.
And
so,
Joe Shanahan from the Metro.
Yeah. So but nobody wanted to really say, well, it's my 60th birthday. So John Langford always jokes about how he was born 2 days after Sputnik was blasted off into space. And, so we're calling it Sputnik's Birthday Party, 1957.
That's great.
Yeah. So kids were encouraging kids and families to come, wear tinfoil hats, dress like it's 1957 space race, bring a spud, put little straws in it, call it a Sputnik.
We're going to have a Sputnik pinata.
Yeah. So we're just saluting the great, great things Russians have done. You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's Saturday, right? That's Saturday night. And then Sunday night.
Yeah. Oh, but wait. So on Saturday, the other thing is it's going to traditionally start off with guitar orchestra. So all those that are listening, if you have a guitar or violin or banjo and you want to come play, it starts off the day at 1:30 with guitar orchestra. So just show up with your instrument and,
That's the idea. Why we do the block party. We've always been participatory, but But now it's really like, you got a guitar, bring it. You get to jam from 1 to 1:30 to 2. If you want to sing, we encourage everybody, kids, teenagers, you can come and you can sing with the Second Ward Choir. We'll have the music there for you. They'll direct it. And we're trying to get as many people as we can for that. And then at 3 o'clock, everyone sings happy birthday. Thank you, Eli's Cheesecake, for providing that great cake. And then we're going to have the 60th birthday party.
Awesome.
And then on Sunday, another guy that was at our party last year was Steve Albini, and he's been part of the Hideout forever, and he wanted to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Electrical Audio Studio.
How great is that?
It's awesome. So he picked a bunch of bands. He picked 9 bands that are going to play, and some of the bands, most of them have all played at the Hideout before, and some of them recorded live albums at the Hideout with Steve Albini before, like Screaming Females, Nina Anastasia. They're going to be there.
Certainly Dianoga and Jay Ryan. He's made lots of posters for us.
Yeah, and he does, and they don't play that much. Meatwave, Fax is going to kind of do one of their first shows. So there's going to be some new bands, and then there's going to be some of the great bands that don't play that much. Manor Astro Man is coming up from down south.
Oh, that's
and,
awesome.
They're going to perform. Again, part of that space.
Yeah.
Space Age theme.
Well, you know, you mentioned it. You both mentioned it at the beginning of this interview. The idea of this block party has been around for years now, but it really is a way for you to celebrate the community that's created around the Hideout. Because you mentioned all
Absolutely.
These names and all these musicians and everybody who's involved, but they're, you know, and everyone will play at different plates, different times, and they'll spend time at the bar. But this is really as much about a music festival as it is about a community gathering.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a time for a lot of us to see friends we haven't seen in a long time. People bring their kids, so we get to, you know, see their kids as they've grown over the years. And it's been 21 years, so a lot of some of the young people that are volunteering, you know, they weren't even born when we started, and they're helping us set up, sell merch. It's very participatory.
It's kind of funny because it's totally rock and roll. It's punk rock. But it's also the most family, like all, I guess, American family style thing. For instance, John Linkford will be up on stage jamming out with Skull Orchard and for his 60th birthday. But our backstage intern is Jimmy Linkford, his son, who's 20, who's going to college now. And so it's like, so I know. And that's, we have a lot of like the kids who are now 18, 19, 20. They will not be drinking.
Yes.
They will not be drinking. They will not be wristbanded. They will, but they will, they're going to be there and they're volunteering to help, you know, with the different, you know, setting up the tents and all that. So the block party is really, it's like a family reunion. I know that sounds corny, but it's a kick-ass family reunion that has like Manor Astro Man. And Screaming Females.
I need that in my
that
family.
That was the family.
Room, yeah.
That's and I mean, Screaming Females, the band.
Right.
Okay.
Well, let me ask
That's
you this.
Fine.
For both of you, I mean, the Hideout, and I have said this that, you know, many consider this to be the Hideout to be the best music venue in Chicago. You talk about, you know, putting this Aww. Together for the block party. What I've noticed and have been a part of, but is just that you have been so eclectic in the last couple of years on what you put on stage, whether it be talk shows, political gatherings, book signings, comedy shows. I mean, it's not just music. Where does that come from, the idea of putting stuff on stage that may not be the sort of traditional feel and vibe that the Hideout has brought Chicago in the years past?
Well, for many reasons. One mainly is that the people who are in the audience oftentimes will bring us a brilliant idea, and we're like, go ahead and do it. It sounds like a great idea. So when we first got the Hideout, you know, you go to the bank and you get a loan, and they said, well, what is it you really want this to be? And we said, we want it to be like a community house. And so it kind of has morphed into that. So case in point, think of Mark Baser. He came to us with the idea for the interview show, and we were like, love it, do it. You know, so, and sometimes, too, it's just we ourselves think of an idea that, oh, that would be interesting to have, or we haven't seen something like that. And
what it literally is we're called a music club, But in reality, even from the time we opened up in 96 when we bought it, the Hideout is a conversation that takes place at the bar. So when you're at the bar and you're sitting there talking, you are either, okay, 1 minute you're talking about something super serious. Okay, hence we have political talk shows at the Hideout. And then the next minute, you're just totally joking about a stupid joke. We have stand-up comedians at the Hideout. And then you're talking about the band you want to be in, or you're talking about the band that you love, that you're listening to, that's on the sound system. There's the music, right? And so the Hideout is really like a magazine, or it's just like a normal person. So sometimes you read books. So we have book signings there. And then you want to hear laughs and comedy. So it's not one thing, but it's also, it all comes from, like Katie said, Mark Fazer. It comes from Claire Zulke. It comes from the people who work at the Hideout. They're in bands too. So everybody just says, and it literally is a thing where people say, wouldn't it be cool if we had this band? Wouldn't it be cool if we did this show?
And we have weddings and bar mitzvahs. And we just had a beautiful memorial service on Sunday. And we're really excited about, Tim, tell them about the Mavis book.
Oh, so this is the kind of how worlds collide. Everything comes together and you're like, I can't believe our world is like this. So Mavis Staples, first of all, when she recorded her live album at the Hideout in 2008, we were like, okay, we're there. It can never get better than that. And it was one of those crazy things where at the last minute she wanted to do a live show. They wanted to do it at the Hideout. They're like, can we do it next week? It happened really fast. And we couldn't sleep for a week. Then she did it, and it turned out better, like it surpassed expectations. And it isn't like you think, like, this is going to be really cool. It's like, oh, my God, I just saw this happen before my eyes. At that night in 2008, Jeff Tweedy was there. And Jeff Tweedy and Wilco saw her. They went, and they talked to her after the show, and they said, let's make some music together. They made these three albums, another one's coming out, and she won a Grammy. And Greg Kot from the Tribune, he wrote this story about that, okay? And he turned it into this book called I'll Take You There.
Right.
So we, when that happened, we're like, awesome, we're in a book, and it tells the history. That really happened. Now we know for the history. Mavis Staples, Wilco, The Hideout, meet a Grammy comes out of it. And then the city of Chicago last weekend chose I'll Take You There by Greg Kot, the life story of Mavis Staples, to be the one city, one book. And on page one of that book, it starts out, Mavis was backstage at the Hideout block party. Yeah, the Hideout block party, where she's done two block parties since she did that live album.
So I love it.
The Hideout is now on page one of the one city, one book, and in chapter 41 and 42. And as a 20-year Chicago public school teacher, who I was one of the teachers who had to, like, teach the kids Stuart Dybeck's book and Kill a Mockingbird and some of the other books that they had, it's like, I know, like, it's crazy. There's going to be 400,000 Chicago public school kids that are going to go, what? I got to read that stupid book. And then they're going to open it up, and they always get to page five. And on page one, it's backstage at the Hideout. So I know they're going to read that part.
There you go.
I know. So it's kind of like we're pretty it's anyway.
Awesome.
That's where, like, the bookish part, the actual street cool civil rights, Mavis Staples part, the alt country Wilco part, the writer who hangs out, Greg Kot part, you know.
It's all there.
Here come together. And that's the Hideout.
That's awesome. Tim Tutton, Katie Tutton, the Hideout block parties this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 1354 West Waubonsie. If you haven't been, you got to go. If you've been, you know exactly what it is and how great it is. Tim, Katie, thanks for joining me tonight. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. I just want to say one more thing. It's free, and we're just asking for donations, and the donations go to Foundation for Music. So
you're going to be supporting more kids in Chicago public schools get music education, and hopefully they'll have that book by Greg Kot.
There you go. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you're partying so that kids can read and learn. It's a good thing.
I think I'm going to go to the Hideout block party. I love that place. You know, I've done so many shows there. The speaking of Alderman Ed Buss, we did the Alderman Ed Buss 53rd Ward show there, where we pretended it was at the back of Ed Buss's restaurant, the Ed Buss Chop House, Alderman Ed Buss Chop House. But we had like politicians during the 2015 mayoral campaign would come through. They would be my guests, and Ed Buss would be the host, so I'd interview him in character. But I've done stuff. I was original with Claire and Funny Haha, and with Baser in the interview show.
Yeah,
it's so true, though. I mean, it really, it's like a community. And I think about Lawrence is behind the bar, you know, and yeah, all the people that we've met over the years, been on this show. It is kind of like that. Katie kind of nailed it. It's like you get a chance to see a bunch of your friends all at once.
I went, you know, I love that place. And I was at the, they do the South by Southwest thing every year. And then, but they take a picture, you know, they take a picture every year. And we like to go there early, get there for the first few bands. Right. And then like when it gets crowded, we kind of take off. So we get there early and Katie comes in. She's like, all right, get out. Everybody get out. We're taking the picture. And me and Molly, my wife, we're looking at each other, what? And like, she was like, everybody out of the bar. So like all these Hideout employees and bands and stuff are like a huge picture out in front of the Hideout. And then me and my wife are there. We have really, other than being fans of the place and going in there, we're in there. Or I've in always, like, their picture.
I've always enjoyed, I mean, I remember, I can date myself. I think it would have been 1999 where Mia Park was doing, used to be a host Chick a Go Go. She had a show at the Hideout called Potluck or something like that. And she asked Schadenfreude to come do a sketch, and we did it at the Hideout. And this was before Baser, way before everybody. We had just, way before our time. And I just remember it became a lore story. Because there was a dog at the Hideout at the time. And we were on stage doing the sketch and nobody cared. There wasn't a huge audience and everyone was just like, you know, it was like when I was doing sketch comedy and everyone's just kind of watching in this theater as opposed to laughing at the jokes. And you're like, this is not going well. And the dog just jumps up on stage and starts like licking Kate's arm while she's doing
it. Was everybody going nuts? You know, bring a dog?
No, it was just like, that's a dog. But it was just hilarious. Like, that became a running joke, like, of bad gigs where you're like, well, we'd always just laugh and say something to the effect of, well, at least there wasn't a dog on stage. And interesting, Manor Astroman, which is a great surf punk band. I have a connection to those guys, too. We opened, they were living in Chicago, maybe doing stuff with Albini and Electrical Audio, and they would come to the Heartland Studio Theater and watch Schadenfreude. And then we became friends, and they would tour, and when they came back through at Metro, they asked us to open for them. So Schadenfreude, my comedy group, opened for Manor Astroman, a sold-out show at Metro, and we totally bombed because it was local sketch comedy before a surf punk, like, they're just like, what? Like, the audience is like, what is this? We don't understand what's happening. And I didn't understand what's happening. We had a lot of fun. We had, like, fake waiters going through the audience. Like, it was because it was some theme we were going from. It was around Christmas time or something. I just remember there was a lot of themes we tried at Metro, and it did not work out. So, anyway, I got to go and see those guys and make an appearance at the block party this weekend.
It's time for swap meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for swap meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. It's a swap meet sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market every Wednesday night here at 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam at Two-Page Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, ready to evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. How you been, buddy?
Doing great.
Question for you. It's September.
Right.
So garage sales, yard sales, flea markets, those kind of things, they start to
yeah, coming down a little bit, but this nice weather this week, there'll be quite a few, and so it should be a good weekend. Also, Saturday, Justice, the Village of Justice is townwide.
Oh yeah,
and then of course Sunday, I'm at Wolf's.
Well, there you go. So you got it all mapped out.
Yep, that's my routine.
No trouble for Greg.
Right, no problem.
He's all
just keep
good.
Finding those treasures.
That's right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right. So every week before we start, you bring in the goodies that you found the week before. You got some great stuff tonight. Let's
it's
dig
a little bit
right
different.
Into it. Let's start with the Great America poster. This okay. is cool.
Yes, I got this at an estate sale a couple months ago, actually. I found four of them, and they were about $1 or $2 each. And I've sold them for like $150, $200, just crazy amounts.
Wow.
And yeah, they're pretty rare. I mean, this one is the Tidal Wave, and it's back when it was Marriott's,
oh,
of
man,
course.
Look
so that's dates
at
about 1977, 78. So
look
that's
at that Tidal
rare.
Wave. That was the best one.
Yep. I was stuck on the Tidal Wave.
You got stuck
yep,
on how?
Not yeah. on the loop, but on like one of
when
the
when you went
ends.
Up the end?
Yeah, one of the ends. I was stuck on it, yeah.
How'd you get down?
It just took about 45 minutes, and they finally got it moving again.
Oh,
so
my
just
kind of
sit there, yeah.
That's
you
like
know,
life-changing.
But there was that one time that people got stuck upside down there.
They did?
Yeah, there was. I think there was one time that people got stuck upside down.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, I don't pay close enough attention to the world of roller coasters, but I believe the Tidal Wave is gone.
Yeah, that I'm not
I
sure.
I feel like I went looking for it last time I was there with my son because I felt like that would be an easy one to introduce him to, and I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah, probably
Tidal
not.
Wave. But the Batman and Robin... And Joker and every
Superman,
other superhero.
All those, yeah.
Yeah, that's there.
They're there.
You're wrong. That's yeah. all. That's all fine and dandy.
But they're
old-fashioned Tidal Wave.
Yeah.
Nope.
But there is like a cult following of just roller coaster
yeah.
fanatics. And I know one of the posters I sold, it was Willard's Wizard. And I sold it to the operator who operated that back in the day.
What?
Yeah, and he's a roller coaster nut, but he actually worked at Great America and operated, so that's why he wanted
the
poster. Yeah, Willard's Wizard, it was called.
Oh, really?
So anyway, so there's that. And
that's
so
awesome,
kinda neat.
Man. This is awesome.
Pretty
just
rare.
Looking at the – it looks very like 50s, 60s, like with the – everything looks new.
Yeah, early 70s, yeah, whatever it was there.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and then I brought another poster.
Okay,
of,
what else you got here?
Wrigley pre-lights.
Yeah, I
the
had this poster
marathon
when I was a
poster.
Kid. Yes.
So,
this is the Marathon Gas poster. That's a shot of the north side of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Wrigley Field, but it doesn't have the lights. It's pre-lights.
Pre-lights.
And this is a nice one. Mine, though, I think is more authentic because it's got the little pinholes
there you go.
All over it,
right.
Probably like 9 in every corner.
Yep.
One of the corners ripped off. At one point went with the masking tape.
Right.
Instead of the
stick 'em stuff
yeah.
in the back.
Yeah. Rip that right yeah. off. So there's like a missing corner on the left.
Sure.
Mine, much more authentic.
Yes.
This is all. I love this
yeah,
because
it's
this really
a neat
shows...
poster. I brought that to the flea market and it gets people looking at it every time it stops them.
I love it. That's the pre 1988? When was the lights? The
so
lights is
88, right?
88? What are you talking about?
88? Was it that long ago? That's what I was thinking.
The lights?
Yeah, probably
yeah,
88. Yeah, because it was all 8s. 88.
Yeah, Greg Maddox's was not an...
Yeah, I just can't believe it was that long ago.
He's a great grandpa, but 2008.
Yeah.
He's still pitching, but 1988, and so this poster is pre-1988.
Pre-88, yeah.
That sounds like a good starting point for the swap meet tonight.
Yep.
And like, you do have memorabilia, classic stuff that's pre-lights. At Wrigley Field.
Oh yeah,
you know you're gonna.
We'll get all
stuff.
That. Yeah.
But I mean that's a very I like that because it shows it also you can really dig into that poster and see the surrounding buildings. Is the Yum Yum Donut still there?
I
bet
could,
it is.
I could see the McDonald's. I know that.
Yeah, there Clark you go. Street. So I'll look for the in the break. I'll look for the Yum Yum Donuts.
Yep,
it's my favorite.
Yep.
All right, and then you got some
just some 57 1960 ephemera of Chrysler, Oldsmobile,
yeah,
Pontiac. You know brochures from the dealers. And, you know, the car guys like this because if they have that car, not only do they want the manual for the car in the glove box, but they'll have this in the car as well to just kind of give it that much more
pizzazz,
authenticity.
Yeah. All right, 312-981-7200. Can you top what Greg's got tonight? He's got the Great America Tidal Wave poster. He's got the pre-lights poster for Wrigley Field and Wrigleyville at the time, East Lakeview. And also some brochures from old cars. 312-981-7200. What do you got? It's a swap meet. Stay with us. All right. They're coming in. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet. I'm Justin Kaufman, Greg Flamm here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Why don't we start with Rich? Rich, what do you want to brag about, bud?
Yeah, I've got this wooden camel.
Mm-hmm.
It's kneeling on a wood base, and it's at least Well, my grandfather passed away in 57, and it was his. And it's got a cutout in its back so you can put a pack of Camel cigarettes in it.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So it's some type of promotional thing, sure, from Camel from at least the 50s, if not the 40s. And I've got the brass ashtray that goes with it that's got the Camel logo engraving in it. Hmm. I was just wondering if that's worth anything other than as a keepsake, because there's still the...
No, it sure is worth something. Promotional, you know, makes it rare, so there's not that many out there for people to find. So I'm trying to get you a price on that. I might not be able to since it is so rare.
Does that stuff usually go for big...
Yeah, it definitely sells. It's just a matter of how much at that point, because you know, you just couldn't buy those. You know, so if there is one available on the market, it will usually sell. I'm just trying to get a price here for you.
All right, cool.
I've even got one of the old cigarette packs.
Yeah, I mean that alone. I mean,
of course, it's empty, but right. You know.
Yeah. I think you got something. I think it's a cool bragger. For sure, but we'll see if it's worth something.
Yeah, I'm not finding anything, but I'm thinking it's going to be to start maybe $250 to $300 to start.
Wow, there you go.
Okay.
All right.
I think that's what kind of hooked me on Camels, from not the cigarettes, but the animals.
Yeah.
You know, from
Joe Camel.
Yeah,
he wasn't around back then, I know, but yeah, they had.
I think they do camel rides up at Gobert's or something. So right. If you really want to get at it.
Yeah, and I took a camel ride in Egypt too when I was in the army. Okay. So.
There you go. So you got
full circle.
So, all right, thanks, Rich.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Yep, thanks.
All right, there we go. All right, I got a bunch of people on the line. Let's get to them. It's coming in fast and furious. Andrew, what do you want to brag about, Andrew?
I just got out of a live auction in Wheaton.
Okay.
And I picked up two World War II spotter toys. One is a German Messerschmitt 210.
Okay.
And the other is, pardon?
Spotter toys? We mean spotter like...
To like train people how to recognize the aircraft. They had cards, but they also made some toys, like models.
Yeah,
so
right.
You could, not so much for playing with, but looking just like the aircraft.
Okay.
So you could learn how to recognize it. So I got a P-39 from June of 1942,
wow.
And it doesn't have the date on it, but a German Messerschmitt 210.
What drew you to these objects at the auction? What was it? You're like, this is what I want to get in on.
Well, you go to an auction, you see stuff, and I thought I could maybe pick it up cheap and potentially sell it for more. But I'm kind of a history buff, so it's kind of fun to recognize that someone was possibly using these to recognize and differentiate enemy and friendly aircraft, right?
Yeah, so right. That's cool.
It had a practical use.
Yeah, I'm. It's out of my wheelhouse, so I'm trying to find some prices here for you. But yeah, there's obviously a huge market for.
Yeah, but you. I mean, what I would say, Andrew, is you know, because you're going into an auction, you know that's gonna be. What do you think it's worth?
Oh, I think they're. I mean, in pristine condition, which these aren't, they probably could go for easily 70, but a little bit less than that. But I paid $5, so
yeah, nice
for both. So.
I'm finding some prices now, some as high as, let's see, some of the ship spotter signs, I guess there were, went for $260. I'm trying to find some of the other toys, or not toys, but the smaller models, $40, like you said, $70. So, yeah, you're in the range there. Hopefully you paid quite a bit less and got a good deal.
There you go.
$5. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. That's great. Awesome,
Keep
Andrew.
Up the work. Great work. I love
thanks.
Your show.
Thank you.
Thanks, man, and thanks for calling. Bye. All right, there you go. Let's go. Let's keep going. I like these. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Yeah, hey, I got a Lionel catalog from the 60s, and what it does is it shows all the different Lionel train models that you could buy, the accessories, and then the neat thing that's in the catalog is you could buy Lionel stock, train stock, from Colonel Lionel.
Wow. Colonel Lionel.
Yeah, Colonel Lionel, and it was like, what? You know, it's like pretty neat.
That is. That's definitely different.
Yeah, the trains. And I had the cast iron trains, and I gave them to my nephew, and they blew them up with firecrackers and that after I found out what they were worth. You know, this was years ago. It's like, oh, my trains. You still have my box of trains? No.
Wow, yeah. I'm seeing some of the older catalogs go for $30 to $50, but if you still have that stock page or option in there,
it's
sure.
Yeah, it's all in the, It's all in there with the. It hasn't been sent in. The magazine itself is a little old, but it's pristine as far as everything's in there.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure it would be higher than with the stock page in there.
Yeah. All right, I'll have to go to the Museum of Science and Industry.
There you go, Jim.
They're interested with their train set.
Awesome.
Thanks, Jim.
All thanks right, for
man.
Calling.
All right, you guys thanks. Hang in there.
Thank you,
buddy. All right, one more. Let's do Russ. Hey, Russ, what do you want to brag about, Russ?
Yeah, I have an old, from the 70s, Leroy Neiman. It's a print painting of the harness racing at Sportsman's Park.
Ooh, oh, wow. I like that. I'm listening.
There we go, Sportsman's.
So it's local.
Yeah, and Sportsman's is no longer. They went out about 20 years
right.
ago.
Right, I know, right? I like that, harness yeah. racing. So it's harness racing. The painting is harness racing?
Yes, and he was at the track, and he did it. And then he signed up. You signed up. Then they, a couple weeks later, they had him at the track, and then he signed them. The
oh,
print.
Wow. Oh, that's you know. Cool. Is your sign?
So I don't know. It's got a metal frame. Yeah, he signed it. Lower right-hand corner.
Yeah, I'm not finding any sold, but there are two currently available, and they range from $300 down to $70. I'm trying to see if those were actually signed as well. For you to give you a better idea.
Yeah, and I looked on the site. I must have looked at a couple hundred of his different pictures that you know, he was known for all kinds of sports.
Mm-hmm, right.
Football, you name. And he had a few with the racetracks, but I never found one from Sportsman's posted, you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah, this one doesn't say signed, so you might be on the higher end of more than 300 there.
You're in the money.
And I don't have a original Neiman, but I have the Burger
who's
King.
The who's the market for buying it? I want to get rid of it.
You want to get rid of it?
Yeah, I don't want it. I like thoroughbreds better than harness anyway.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
I'd like to sell it, so who how do I go? Go to a...
if you have a family member that maybe market? Can list it for you online or...
You have two options. You go online to eBay, put that thing up, or B, find a corner. And just pull your van up and put it out there and just hold out there with a little sign that says $75 and
or
someone will
camp
come
out at Balmoral Park.
Ask
something.
The guys who sell the rugs on Harlem if you can piggyback on their work.
Right. No, you'll get the higher end if you can get someone to list it online for you.
Yeah, because right. I've seen a lot of these paintings. They're asking $600, $400, all around. Yeah. Anywhere from $100 all the way up to $1,000, you know.
Yeah, I would recommend an auction starting at maybe $349. And just see if it goes up from there.
All right. Thanks, Russ. Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
He needs to go get... I saw the one of the best. I forgot it was on Western. It was one of the guys who pulls the van up, and they got the area rugs. They got them out there.
Yeah.
And it was just the face... It was a black rug with the face of Tupac.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want that. I almost stopped. I was like, I need that in my living room. The wifey wouldn't go for it.
I never see the rugs. I always see the wooden trains, the wooden work, you know, like on 83 there.
Yeah, so he just needs to pull up there and be like, right. how much to put this harness racing post picture up. 312-981-7200. Let's keep going. Let's go to text. I got, what's the value of a Cuddly Dudley doll? In the original box, never played with. Cuddly Dudley Express. Oh, that's so sad. Never played with.
The Express, I guess, was a train or a car that was with it. Mm-hmm. Just the Cuddly Dudley is between $150, $300 if it's great in the box. And then it goes up from the
Express. Is that like an
Express.
Old doll kind of thing?
It was the dog. Wasn't it on Ray Rayner, the dog?
Oh, okay.
If I'm not mistaken. But it's an old, you know, vintage toy dog.
Sad. That their whole life they've been holding on to this thing. They're like, I really want to cuddle Cuddly Dudley.
At least it is something. I see quite a few that have sold, so it's still something that people are buying, so that's good.
All right, there you go. 312-981-7200. We're doing a swap meet tonight. Greg Flamm in the building at DuPage Picker at Facebook and Twitter. Give us a call. We'll evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, and, of course, your junk. 312-981-7200. Second half coming up.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for swap meet. With Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Here we are.
That's right. This swap meet is sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. 312-981-7200. 7200. This is where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Laura. Laura, what do you want to brag about, Laura?
Hi.
Hi.
I have a book. It's Fantasia. I believe it says second printing, so I assume that's the first edition, second printing, and it's Walt Disney Fantasia.
Yeah.
Got a foreword by Leopold Sikorsky. Nice. And I'm just wondering what kind of value it might
Greg,
add.
Greg, let me just step in real quick. Laura's got a book called Fantasia. It's where the mouse... He doesn't want to do the chores, so he uses the sorcerer's magic to get brooms to do it for him. But they get out of control. It gets messy. He doesn't know how to stop them. They multiply.
Sounds like a coming-of-age tale.
There's a million brooms. He really wrecks the whole place.
Okay.
I think that Did I sum up Fantasia? I think I got it, right?
Got it.
All right. What's it worth, Greg?
Well, first edition looks like, there's someone asking $800 right now for one, but that doesn't mean that's what they'll get. One looks like it's sold for $40, so there's a big swing there. So
So anywhere between $40 and $800, yeah, Laura.
I think you're closer to probably $100 to $200.
All right. That's good.
I paid $1.25 for it.
There you go.
All right, there you
Still
go.
Not bad.
That's good. All right, thanks, Laura.
Thanks for calling.
Does she mean a buck and a quarter like she's being cool, saying $125
right,
or
right.
A dollar and a quarter?
Sportsman's, that's what that would mean.
He thinks, the mouse thinks, he can control these brooms, and he can't.
He can't. Futile.
Let's go to Cindy. Cindy, what do you want to brag about, Cindy?
Hi.
Hi.
So I have this book. It's like 11 by 14. It was put together by the Chicago Chamber of Commerce.
Ooh.
And I want to say, yeah, it's really cool, actually. It's before the Sears Tower was built. So it's basically, you know, all about every page is about the beaches, about the shopping. You know, definitely a tourism book. Wrigley Field, you know, things like that. So, you know, I have no idea. It was a gift to me from my grandmother. I have no idea what it's worth or where it even came from, other than that it was probably a tourism book.
Is it a booklet or like hardcover book? Or
it's a booklet.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
And like I said, it's bigger than an 8x10.
Sure. Yeah, I know exactly. I have similar stuff to that, and you're probably in the $20 to $25 range. If it was signed or if it was a hardcover, it might be worth more than that. But yeah, I've brought some in before and showed Justin, some of the older commerce books and just Chicago guides from back in the 50s and 60s. Yeah, it's great to see the skyline like how it was back then and just what they were pushing for, you know, visitors to look at.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of fun. I love looking at it even.
Yeah,
today.
I say keep that. Don't sell it. And keep it as a party favor.
Yep. Put it on
a
coffee table. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. It's a bragger. That's right. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. There we go. Let's keep going. Let's go to Nick. Similar stuff. Nick, what do you want to brag about?
Hey, my dad gave me it's like a portrait kind of picture thing for a wall. And it's got a bunch of Chicago landmarks that are engraved into some sort of stone or marble.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's got like Wrigley Field, I believe Soldier Field down there, the Field Museum, different buildings that are prominent to Chicago.
Right.
I have no idea what it's worth, something like that, but I wanted to see if you guys ever saw or heard of something like that.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those, and they're kind of common in this area, obviously, with Chicago, but you can get them as low as $20 at a garage sale, maybe lower sometimes. Some people just don't know what they're worth, but they are worth a little bit more, probably $100 to
$200. Oh, there you go.
Cool.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Nick.
You bet.
I like those. Okay, let's keep going. Let's go to Joanne. Joanne, what do you want to brag about, Joanne?
Okay, I have Charlie Tuna watch, radio.
Wow.
A clock. And an old-fashioned sewing machine, which is like a desk. You open it up.
And that's Charlie Tuna as well?
No, it's a regular sewing machine.
Okay, we were on Charlie Tuna. Sorry.
I thought you were talking. I thought I was like, wow, you got a lot of Charlie Tuna.
A big Charlie Tuna fan. But do you know what brand the sewing machine is?
It might be, I don't know. It was my mom. She was like 87 years old. So this is like it's a desk where you open up the desk, you lift it up, and you can sew in everything on it.
Sure.
Wow.
Well, we'll concentrate on the Charlie Tuna stuff then. The camera is anywhere from $50 to $90 for the camera. If you said it was in the box and everything, you have everything with it.
Yes.
Yeah, you're probably on the higher end of
$90. Wow.
You said you had a radio and...
I have a radio, a clock, a watch, and also the lamps and a rug.
Sure. The radio's in the like $20 to $30 range. And then you, what was the last one? A clock? Sorry.
A clock, a radio, lamps, two lamp sets, and a rug.
Oddly enough, I've only had the cookie jar, the Charlie Tuna cookie jar, but that did get about $75, so I'm happy with that.
All right.
But yeah, someone's asking like $200, $400 for the clock. It's like a wind-up alarm clock. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those. Uh-huh. That seems to be your winner there.
Wow, there you go.
I'm thinking... Joanne. You know, 200 and up for that one.
200 and up for a little clock. I love it.
Yep.
All right.
And then probably the lamps, too, probably. Those will probably be expensive, too.
Yeah, I didn't get to those, but yeah.
For sure. All right, thanks, Joanne.
Thank you.
Okay. 312-981-7200. 630 says, okay, I got a brag for you. I have 11 original Apple stock certificates.
Wow.
From 1987. Maybe the real brag is getting in on the ground floor thanks to my father's wisdom. He's no longer mad that he missed the McDonald's IPO.
Okay.
That's good stuff.
Can't even imagine what those are worth.
Yeah, they're worth a lot. As he says, though, at the end, this is funny. As he says, though, in time of war or destruction, you can't eat paper stocks. I guess you're right, but
you're
still.
Right.
That's awesome. That's an awesome brag. There you go. That's how you play. 312-981-7200. 708 says, Justin, you're showing your youth. Thank you. Thank you. When I was a kid, you would often see a cuddly Dudley ripped up in the alleyways. Its styrofoam like guts would be blowing all over. But thanks for the memories.
Yep. Yeah. And that's why they're worth what they are nowadays, because many people destroy them.
847 says, I found a high wheel bike, penny farthing, and a plate on the back frame that says new mail and a patent stamp that looks like 1887. Mostly original, not rusty. Can't find it on eBay. What should I do? Should I contact museums? So that's like the high wheel bikes like that you get from like the old days, like two guys. Or
right. You had to kind of push it and then jump on it to ride it. And they're on American Pickers all the time. He's a nut about those bikes. And they can go for upwards of like $1,500, $2,000, depending on the condition and the brand and what year. So you don't have to go to a museum for that. You could probably go, try to find a mom and pop bike store. They'll be able to point you in the right direction on that.
All right. 708 says, I worked for the Chicago White Sox from 1959, that's the year they won the pennant, to 1963. I have a baseball that I watched all the players autograph, and I have one from the New York Yankees, same year, that's Maris and Mantle. What are these worth? Wow.
Yeah, that's...
Maris and Mantle.
Trying to get a price there.
A baseball signed by the entire Yankees of that generation. That'd be pretty good. You know, I have to say my Achilles heel, Pete, you'll love this. My Achilles heel is in baseball is I know people get mad at me. I love baseball. Love baseball history. I could, like, we do the 80s baseball players. Love all that stuff, right? But there's something about the Yankees celebrity star players that I cannot place what years they played. So when they say Maris and Mantle, I'm like, the 20s? Babe Ruth, I'm like, 1950?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it's just like I lose track of all of it because they had so many stars and they broke so many records. I'm always like, it's mostly Roger Maris. I'm like, when did Roger Maris play? Like, 50s? 40s?
61?
61? Was that it? He hit 61 home runs? In 61?
No, I don't.
I'm showing what I'm saying, like, 65 ball, but
I would
then
have
he could have signed it
I would have thought Roger Maris played in the 30s, wouldn't you? I mean, I would think that, like, all of those Yankees that are always talked about were played in the 30s. But
like your Paul O'Neills.
Tito. Right. Your, what was it, Tito? What was that guy's name? Wasn't Martinez. What was the guy's name?
Danny Tartable.
Danny Tartable.
Oh, yeah. Uh-oh.
Don't start.
Yeah.
Don't start.
Here we go.
Don't bring it in.
Obscure Yankees for 300.
No, who's the guy who they? Well, it doesn't matter. All right, let's not even start.
Just a Maris Mantle. Those two sign ball is going for 500 to 800.
Wow.
If he knows for sure, obviously, if he has any kind of documentation, which I know will be hard, but we talked about it before, the team sign balls tend to drag down the value because it's so hard to verify all those signatures, and sometimes they were. He says, you know, he saw them sign it. That's hopefully the case. But, yeah, if just those two are getting 500, 800, if he could have an authentic ball, it could be in the couple thousand range.
Woo! Wow.
So we'll see how that works out.
312-981-7200. Swap Meet, Greg Flamm, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. We'll wrap it up here. We still have time for some more calls and some texts. We got some stuff lined up. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm in the building at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We take our calls and continue to evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. All right, let's go to Jeff. Jeff, what do you want to brag about, Jeff?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I bought some Beanie Babies back in the 90s, back in the craze. Her friend talked her into it, and I'm thinking, this is stupid. Anyway, having dinner the other night, and a friend of hers said, going through some of her kids' stuff online, people are asking like, you know, $14,000, $20,000 for these things.
I know, right?
Yeah, they can ask all they want for them. You got to click the sold box, usually on the left on the home computer side of eBay. Click that sold button and see what they're actually selling for. They're not selling for that. There are, you know, a handful that might be a few hundred. But for the most part, I mean, I see them every weekend, 75 cents, 50 cents. So, there's
the lore and the rumor of like specific ones.
Right.
If you have, it's kind of like the Monopoly game at McDonald's or the Jewel, where you're like, you never actually get Z22, you know, but if you got Z22, you're in the money. So that's what you have to figure out with Beanie Babies, which ones are the most rare.
They're the needle in the haystack kind that are worth, you know, quite a bit. But yeah, you're not really going to have those.
Yeah, so
she has one supposedly. I guess a piece.
Yeah, the piece one, Jerry Garcia one, whatever they call that one. That one I've seen for a couple hundred dollars. It can go for
a couple hundred.
That's what I've seen for. I know people ask crazy amounts, but it's there's all kinds of websites that debunk a lot of the $1,000 Beanie Baby thing.
Right.
We talked about it before. I think they're going to come back not in their original form, but kind of like a Pokemon Go type game where you're going to need them for some reason and someone's going to invent a game, you know, that you're going to need them. So I said it here, so take it and run with that.
Well, like you said, I mean, what you ask for and what you pay for are two different things.
Exactly, right. Click that sold box.
There you go.
And see what they're selling for.
Awesome.
All right, thanks,
Jeff. Thanks for calling.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Christine. Christine, what do you want to brag about, Christine?
Hi, I have an old Cubs program from about, it's either 71 or 72.
All right.
And, you know, it was all penciled in and all. And the autograph I have is in pencil, but it's from Lou Brock.
Okay. Ooh, yeah, short-lived Cub.
Right.
And
they trade him to St. Louis?
St. Louis, yeah.
That's like one of the classic like Cubs mess up trades, right?
Brock for Brolio in the '60s, and it's. Let me just say, I want to get this off my chest. I was at the game. You know, I was at the game, the Cubs Cardinals game over the weekend, and you're a really irritating type of troll when you break out the St. Louis Cardinals Lou Brock jersey to wear at the Cubs game.
I just want to get that off my chest. I like the bravado.
Nice.
That's like a pirate. That's like a pirate fan wearing a Madlock. Madlock jersey. All right, what do you think about a program from the early 70s?
Someone asking 50 for one. I'm trying to find an actual.
But this is signed by Lou Brock.
Yeah, that was signed as well. I can't find any sold. Normally, a Cubs program without a signature is in the $11 to $15 range.
Like
60s to 70s era. But if they're signed, obviously they can go up depending who signed them. But there's one asking 50, so I'm guessing you're in that ballpark too. If you want to sell it, I think you'd probably be better to sell for like 30 to 40 maybe.
There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much, Christine.
Thank you.
I just found your program. So
awesome.
I'll be
keep
calling
listening.
You back.
Keep calling. We appreciate
thank
it.
You. All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Let's go to Lynn. Lynn, what do you want to brag about, Lynn?
Hi. I have a copy of a Time magazine from the 1960s with a picture of the Beatles on the cover and their first trip to the United States.
Wow. Wow. I love it. All
Let's
right.
Let's see what we can find here.
The first trip to the United States, Time magazine.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder if the Beatles made a Time magazine cover and put it up in their office, even though they were not already.
Yeah, the Time magazine, this is 1967. Is it September 22nd? Is that the one?
I couldn't say for sure. I don't have it right in front
no
of
problem.
Me.
No problem.
It sounds like it. They're actually coming off the plane.
Okay, yeah, that's not this one. I don't see any Time magazines with that. I do see Life. That's about 50. The other Time magazine from 67 was about $100. So,
all right, so you're in that area.
You're in that area.
Okay, and that's, I think it might be worth it to just hang on to it. I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, obviously the longer
party
with
started.
Beatles, yeah.
When the party lulls, when you guys are done with Parcheesi, and you're like, hey, you guys want to see something cool?
Right.
Right.
And everybody loves you. All right, there you go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep going. 312-981-7200. Do a couple texts, and then we'll wrap up tonight. Let's see. 708 says, Crestwood House Movie Monsters Books, Revenge of the Creature, Dracula's Daughter, Tarantula. What? What does that mean?
Yeah, they were books obviously put out by Crestwood House, and a lot of them have sold for about $80 for like a lot of 8 or 10.
Okay.
So you're in that ballpark. Individual, you'll probably be in the $10 to $20 range maybe. So,
okay.
Yeah, but they are kind of cool. I would definitely pick those up if I saw them.
All right. 847, still in the Converse All-Stars box. I kept them in since 1976, talking about shoes.
Shoes, yeah.
No. Sorry, let me rephrase. There were two texts split up. Mm. Comics, early 1970s Justice League and Avengers. Rough to fair condition, still in the Converse All-Stars box that I kept him in 1976.
Well, that makes a big difference.
That's great.
The Converse box. Nice. That is grading is everything with the older comics, so I can't even really venture to guess on that. I'm going to say 300 to
2,000. It is all about grading, right?
They're very picky.
And they go...
Yeah, they
Let me
smell
this.
That's right. Is the staple a little bit rusted? Is the dog-eared corner? I mean, they look at everything, and they will nitpick that thing apart.
Smells like you ate Sloppy Joe near this 1970s Avengers.
Right.
All right. 312-981-7200, but we're going to shut it down right now. We're at the end of the hour. Thanks to everyone who called, and there's a whole line of calls right now, so I apologize that we didn't get you in tonight. We'll get you in next week if you want to call back. Same to the texters. Text in early. We have this problem all the time. We start at 10 o'clock, and we're like, oh, yeah, we'll just kind of shoot the breeze.
10 o'clock every Wednesday.
Yeah, and then 10:52, and it's like, oh,
bam.
I got an idea. And then we get an onslaught of awesome things to talk about. Yep. All right. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, joins us every Wednesday here on the download for the swap meet here on 720. Greg, great to see you, buddy.
Great. Thank you, Justin.